of aging.
We can hopefully slow down the aging process and hopefully make people live healthier for longer.
Sliced Bread with me, Greg Foote, Thursday lunchtimes at 12:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And this is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 20th of August. Good morning. This is Today with Justin Webb in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention and Michelle Hussein in London.
Headlines this morning. In an emotional and sometimes angry speech, Joe Biden has called Donald Trump a loser and a convicted felon. He endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris, as the party's candidate for the November election. I'll be talking to a woman who was one of Joe Biden's closest advisors, who tells us he could have won this election, even after his disastrous debate. And I'll also be reporting on the Gaza protests outside the convention centre. The president said the protesters had a point. And one other headline, the search for six people missing after a luxury yacht sank off the coast of Sicily is resuming this morning.
Also in today's programme, a space probe has been successfully propelled towards Jupiter in a manoeuvre described as the first ever double slingshot. The UK Space Agency will be with us live to explain. How a search of the BBC archive has revealed this from 1963.
I'm Ringo and I play the drums.
I'm Paul and I play the bass.
I'm George and I play a guitar.
I'm John and I too play a guitar. Sometimes I play the fool.
We'll hear more about the unearthed recordings and how that particular year set the tone for how we remember the 1960s. And... So it's gonna be forever, or it's gonna go down in flames. You can tell me when it's over, if the high was worth the... As Taylor Swift's European tour ends tonight with her last London show, we'll look back at what she brought to the summer of 2024. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
Joe Biden has told Democrats that they're in a battle for the very soul of America. The outgoing president was addressing the party's national convention in Chicago in a speech at times drowned out by chants of "Thank you, Joe." His vice president, Kamala Harris, will be formally confirmed as the Democrats' presidential nominee during the four-day event. Mr. Biden urged supporters to back Ms. Harris at the election in November.
She's tough. She's experienced. And she has enormous integrity. She'll be a president respected by world leaders because she already is. She'll be a president we can all be proud of. And she will be an historic president who puts her stamp on America's future.
The search for six people missing after a luxury yacht sank off the coast of Sicily is resuming this morning. Among them are the British technology tycoon Mike Lynch and his daughter. The 180-foot yacht went down in a storm yesterday. 15 people were rescued, including Mr. Lynch's wife, Angela Bakaris, and a one-year-old British girl. A man's body has been recovered. From Sicily, our correspondent Mark Lowen reports.
More names are emerging of those engulfed by the sea as their superyacht, the Bayesian, capsized here in Porticello. As well as the tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch and his 18-year-old daughter Hannah, Sicily's civil protection says Jonathan Bloomer, the chairman of the investment bank Morgan Stanley International, and Chris Morvillo, a lawyer for Mr. Lynch, are among the six passengers still missing. It's thought likely that bodies will be found trapped on the seabed in the wreckage of the Bayesian, which was hit by a waterspout, a tornado-like column of cloud and water, with the yacht quickly swallowed up by the waves.
The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is travelling to Egypt as he continues his push for a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza. After talks in Jerusalem yesterday, Mr. Blinken said Israel had accepted what he called a bridging proposal and urged Hamas to do the same. More from our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison.
Antony Blinken says Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accepts and supports the so-called bridging proposal. The US Secretary of State now heads to Egypt and Qatar to try to get them to put pressure on Hamas to do the same. But the Islamist group has called US talk of progress an illusion. Overnight, Israel's military says it targeted a Hezbollah weapons store in Lebanon. And Hamas says a number of its senior figures were killed in Israeli airstrikes in Gaza yesterday. It also claimed to have been involved in a bomb attack in Tel Aviv on Sunday.
A former Republican member of the US Congress, George Santos, has pleaded guilty to identity theft and fraud. Santos, who was expelled from the House of Representatives last December, had spent campaign money on Botox treatments, luxury goods and pornography. The judge said he could face up to 8 years in prison when he's sentenced. Speaking outside court in Long Island, Mr. Santos apologised to his constituents.
It has been the proudest achievement of my life to represent you, and I believe I did so to the best of my abilities. But you also trusted me to represent you with honour and to uphold the values that are essential to our democracy. And in that regard, I failed you.
A rocket engine has exploded during a launch test at the UK's new spaceport in Shetland. The test was carried out by RFA, a German company which eventually hopes to launch the UK's first vertical rocket into orbit. 3 months ago, the company's first test at the spaceport on the island of Unst was declared a success. Our Scotland correspondent Lorna Gordon was watching in Shetland.
The full nine-engine ground-based test was part of a number of trials due to be carried out before RFA progressed to launching its rockets into space. A small crowd had gathered across a bay from the spaceport to watch. Large flames and plumes of smoke could initially be seen shooting horizontally from the side of the rocket, and there were loud bangs as the entire structure was then engulfed by fire. In a statement, Saxa Ford Spaceport said all safety protocols were fully observed and the site was evacuated prior to the test, leaving no staff at risk.
Swarms of robot aircraft are being developed in the UK to tackle wildfires by spotting flames and working together to put them out. Final testing is taking place on the self-flying drones, as Harriet Bradshaw reports.
Swarm engineering is a way of making many robots work together on a specific task. A team of firefighters, engineers and scientists from the UK have been testing this approach to see whether it could be used to tackle wildfires. During trials at an airfield in Cornwall, three drones worked together autonomously to spot a real fire, alert the other drones to it before mimicking dropping down as if to put it out with water. The benefits include making it easier to monitor large areas, as well as detect and respond to fires more quickly.
Harriet Bradshaw reporting.
Caroline, thank you very much. It is 7 minutes past six. Thomas Schaffernacker has this morning's weather forecast. Hello, Thomas.
Good morning to you, Michelle. It's a blustery day in the forecast today. We've plenty of showers on the way for Scotland and Northern Ireland, as well as the northwest of England. And if the showers haven't reached you already, they will do through the morning and certainly by the time we get to the early afternoon. The winds will be particularly noticeable around western Scotland and also the north coast of Northern Ireland. Gusts possibly up to around 55 miles an hour later on this afternoon. And also around Irish sea coasts, it will be very blustery. For example, the coasts of Cumbria, also Lancashire. The Pennines will be very blustery too. Temperatures in the northern half of the UK with all of that wind and the showers today, only around 15 or 16 degrees. Now, going a little bit further south, it's not going to be quite as windy, although it will be noticeable. Across Wales and England, showers are expected, a decent breeze out of the west or the northwest too. And the temperatures will be around 18 degrees around the Welsh coasts, the southwest of England, Midlands about the low 20s, but despite the breeze, in East Anglia and the southeast, about 24 or 25. And actually here, we'll have the best of the sunshine. Tonight, the winds should ease, although still staying fairly windy, and the temperatures will be around 10 Celsius. And then the outlook as we head into Thursday, very wet and very windy in the northwest of the UK. Back to you two.
Thomas, thank you. 8 minutes past six. The papers, well, most of them are certainly the paper editions of the papers. We'll find that the events overnight at the Democratic Convention will have happened way, way too late from them. In fact, they were still going on any half an hour or so ago. So the front page is reflecting other events and terrible events too. Hero mum saves baby in sea hell is the Daily Mirror's headline, accompanied by a photo of Charlotte Galunsky, named as one of the survivors. The image on the front of The Guardian showing rescue workers bringing a body ashore. The paper saying that the Foreign Office is providing consular support to a number of families after yesterday's events in and around Sicily.
Lynn Ronald, whose daughter was on board and survived, tells the Daily Telegraph that the purpose of the trip was to celebrate the end of Mike Lynch's recent legal battle in the US. The Times reports the government is sending four marine safety inspectors to Palermo to carry out an initial assessment into the sinking of the yacht. A former member of staff to Mike Lynch tells the paper that the multimillionaire businessman clearly had a lot of pride in the yacht and had decorated the walls of his home in London with photographs of it.
According to a report in the I paper, at least 136 people on remand were held in police stations yesterday as part of an emergency measure or a set of emergency measures to reduce overcrowding in jails. It says the figures come from the Ministry of Justice, and a defence solicitor who isn't named is quoted as saying, "I've never seen anything like it in 28 years.
Queen said Trump was very rude, is the Daily Mail's headline. The claims are made in a new biography of the late monarch by the writer and satirist Craig Brown. In the account serialised in the Mail, the Queen is said to have particularly disliked the way the former president looked over her shoulder as if in search of others more interesting. Her remarks are said to have been made to a guest at a lunch weeks after Mr. Trump visited Britain. The Queen also reportedly mused that Mr. Trump must have some sort of arrangement with his wife Melania.
Few papers feature a recommendation by scientists that primary school pupils should have ice lollies to help them learn about how temperature works. According to The Guardian, it's one of a number of proposals that could become part of an updated curriculum. The Times carries a quote from a policy specialist from the Royal Society of Chemistry, who says, what better prop is there than an ice lolly?
11 minutes past six.
Democracy has been delivered. Now democracy must be preserved. That is what Joe Biden told the convention audience here in Chicago. It was passionate, it was heartfelt, it was personal. He was saying goodbye to his party, giving his backing as well to the woman who has replaced him.
She's tough, she's experienced, and she has enormous integrity. Enormous integrity. Her story represents the best American story. And like many of our best presidents, she was also vice president. That's a joke.
Emma Vardy is our US correspondent who was watching it alongside me. That was a joke, Emma, but it was actually quite an angry speech, wasn't it?
It was. There was a lot of emotion in the arena tonight. It was the moment that Joe Biden effectively handed over the torch to Kamala Harris, but it also served as a farewell speech for him. He talked about his achievements in office. He really went hard after Donald Trump, didn't he? He laid out the choice before Americans as he sees it. He called it a battle for the soul of America. But there was such a warm platform given to him tonight. There were chants of, "We love you, Joe." Democrats had really set the stage for it to be about tributes to him and his legacy. Mm-hmm. But let's not forget, a month ago, many Democrats were in despair over Joe Biden's failings, his seemingly lack of ability to fight against Donald Trump. But inside here tonight, it seemed like all was forgiven. It allowed him to make a dignified farewell while helping to rally support for Kamala Harris.
Yeah, a dignified farewell, though after midnight Eastern time. I mean, this was not prime time, was it? And you've got to feel, haven't you, that if they'd really wanted to showcase this to the nation, they would have done it at a time when the nation might have been watching.
Yeah, put him on a bit earlier. I mean, look, it wasn't running to time. I think he was supposed to be on about 45 minutes or an hour or so earlier. These things often slip a bit. But you're right. You know, you've got your audience inside the arena. But what really matters is the millions of people watching on TV back at home. It's a massive broadcasting operation for American networks here. The Democrats hope that what goes on inside the arena becomes must-watch TV for many people. And I expect most people will see this as highlights clips on the breakfast programs tomorrow morning. But inside here, it was quite a moment. You did feel the emotion. You did feel the warmth for Joe Biden. The bit that a lot of people would have seen was Kamala Harris's appearance much earlier on. She broke with tradition, appeared here to welcome people to the convention. But of course, her big moment, her star turn, comes on Thursday when she makes her speech then.
And we'll hear your report on what was said in about half an hour's time. Emma, for the time being, thanks.
13 minutes past six, a BBC investigation has revealed evidence of how Rohingya people in Myanmar, previously targeted by the country's military and forced to leave their homes, have been attacked by an anti-government insurgent force. Yogita Limai, our South Asia correspondent, joins us from Bangladesh, where she's been investigating this and where many Rohingya refugees now live. What have you found, Yogita?
Michelle, we've been speaking to Rohingyas who've come across the border from Myanmar into Bangladesh over the past 2 weeks. And we've investigated a specific incident which happened on the evening of the 5th of August. And all of them have told us that they were trying to flee the intensifying bombing in the Rakhine state. They were trying to get on boats and come to Bangladesh across the river Naf, which forms the border between Myanmar and Bangladesh in that area. They've said there were hundreds of people gathered by the banks of the river on the Myanmar side. They said they were civilians and that they were bombed using drones by the Arakan army. All of them have named the Arakan army. We've seen footage of the aftermath, which first appeared online. BBC Verify has analysed it. Some of the survivors actually showed us that footage and identified their families, little children, their wives, a lot of women and children seen in these quite disturbing and graphic images. You know, the grounds, some might find these descriptions distressing, but the ground really covered with bodies. And all of the fingers that we're seeing, all of the people who've survived this are saying that it's the Arakan army which did this. Now, we did go to the Arakan army for their response. They didn't agree to be interviewed. But what they've said is that this attack didn't happen under in an area which is under their control and that they have no connection to it. They've also said that Rohingya activists lined up bodies and took videos in order to in order to send them out as propaganda. So that's the response we've received. But what's very clear is that this is another precarious moment for the Rohingyas. In the past 1 week that we were in Cox's Bazar investigating the story, thousands have entered Bangladesh from Myanmar.
Yogita, thank you very much. We'll get your full report on this later on in the programme. The time is now just after 6:15. So Mike Lynch, the tech entrepreneur, and his 18-year-old daughter are among the six people who are still missing after the sinking of his yacht off the coast of Sicily. We'll get an update on the search a bit later, but Will Bain is looking more about Mike Lynch's reputation and what he is known for. Will?
That's right, Michelle, yeah. Mr. Lynch co-founded the software firm Autonomy in Cambridge in 1996, went on to become one of Britain's best-known entrepreneurs as a result, a company he would later sell to Hewlett-Packard for $11 billion in 2011. That sale sparked more than a decade of legal wrangling over the price, though, a case in which Mr. Lynch was finally cleared by a court in San Francisco in June this year. Following his acquittal, he told Evan Davis on the PM programme earlier this month that he wanted to get back to what I love doing, which is innovating. And he had been. His venture capital firm, InWhich, has provided funding to some of the UK's brightest tech startups over the past decade, an area where he met fellow tech entrepreneur Brent Hoberman. Brent co-founded lastminute.com and runs the Founders Forum as well. Morning, Brent.
Good morning.
Met and became friends.
Absolutely. I first met Mike 28 years ago.
And tell us about, I guess, what the last, 24 hours plus have been like then.
Yeah, no, look, it's obviously really tragic that somebody who's been through so much and was on a celebratory trip has had something so tragic happen. And I think it's really, you know, many of us in the UK industry look up to Mike and what he's done and what he's done for UK technology and entrepreneurs. So obviously, I've had messages from people saying that they can't breathe. They are so from our fellow entrepreneurs that they're, you know, waiting on bated breath for better news. But
I mean, have you managed to make contact with anybody for news? Has it been easy to get information?
No, look, I don't want to bother. I think the people who are on the front line of this, I think they've got a lot of their own things to deal with.
Mm. But we touched on the court case there. Your understanding is that this trip was sort of a celebration that all of that was over, and also, of course, that his daughter was going off to university, who was also missing.
Yeah, no, it's super, super sad. Yes, absolutely. No, I mean, I think he deserved a celebration having, you know, beaten the US justice system with very low probability, less than 0.5% of people who do that extradition win. And he had won and cleared his name, which I think, you know, what's interesting is, you know, what he would and hopefully still will be able to achieve. For UK entrepreneurs.
Well, tell us more about him. What made him a good makes
yeah,
him
yeah,
a good
clearly,
entrepreneur.
Yes. I think what's so interesting about Mike is he's that very way. We often say in Britain that people don't take great ideas and technologies and commercialize them well. And what he is somebody with a deep scientific and mathematical brain who also was able to build very successful businesses. So obviously lots of media and press about autonomy, and that business did obviously go into the FTSE 100. Also, he, you know, Darktrace would not, the company that was recently sold for $5 billion would simply not exist, as I understand it, without Mike Lynch. So you've got another super, you know, there are very few people in Britain who've built businesses, multiple businesses of that scale with great technology IP at the heart.
And as you say, someone who is willing to take a chance on startups. We've talked about that an awful lot in this slot over the past year or so about access to capital and taking chances and taking risks. Someone who, if you believed in something, has had a record of doing that.
Yeah, I think huge, in my mind, huge respect and kudos to those people and those entrepreneurs who help support the next generation. So Mike did that obviously with his capital through his company Invoke Capital, but also I think probably even more interesting with his brains and his support for entrepreneurs, with his ability to attract top technology talent. And then advise them, help them, fund them. And he'd been, you know, very successful in that.
And on a human level, how do you deal with the next days, hours, whatever it might be? I mean, are you just sort of pressing refresh on a news website and looking at your phone for messages?
Yeah, I think one's constantly trying to, you know, create structures where good news might happen. You know, people talk about air pockets in these things. I think that sounds like it's the best option. But obviously, you know, as time passes by, one gets more pessimistic, which is deeply, deeply sad. But no, I mean, I think like most people, yes, just glued to the news and hoping for better news.
Well, Brent, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. That's Brent Hoberman there, the Founders Forum and a friend of Mike Lynch's. Let's turn to the financial markets. Rachel Winter, partner investment manager at Killick & Co, is with us. Rachel, morning. More news from the house building sector in the last 24 hours. Looks like Barratt Redrow, a deal that we've talked about a lot on the programme as well. Looks like the two sides are going to push ahead with that, despite the Competition and Markets Authority still keeping its eyes on the deal.
Yes, exactly. So it looks as though they are confident they will eventually get approval from the regulator. I think it has been a difficult few years for the house building sector. They've had labour shortages due to Brexit. They've had rising materials prices post-COVID, and they've had a fall in demand because of rising interest rates. So it's not surprising we are seeing some mergers happening to try and reduce some of those fixed costs. However, it does feel as though we are moving into a better time for house builders, with a big push on new development from the Labour government and also interest rates here in the UK starting to come down.
Right, so a bit of a sense though that from the sector perhaps that size matters, that size is going to be important here.
I think it does make a difference for house builders. It does enable them to keep a lid on some of their costs.
You talked about sort of planning decisions and changes to that. News from City Airport this morning that it's going to be allowed to expand.
Yes, so the previous capacity was 6.5 million passengers per year, and they've been given approval to raise that to 9 million. So still fairly small in comparison to Heathrow, which has 30 million, Gatwick, which has over 40 million. But nevertheless, I think a good decision for City Airport, and I think probably quite a pro-business decision from our new government.
Right. Why so?
Just approving a new project, allowing more passengers to come into London, particularly to an airport like City, which is obviously associated with financial services.
Yeah, interesting kind of sort of mood music around it. Mood music around the market. It's been a lot calmer week for you, I think, this week. Take us through what has caused that kind of calming, both in the US and here.
Well, for the US in particular, we have had some better data from the labour market. We've also had a lower than expected inflation number from the US, and that makes it more likely that interest rates in the US will start to come down. The market has been very happy with that, and therefore we have seen quite a rise in US equities over the last few trading sessions.
Rachel, thanks as always for your time. Rachel Winter there, partner and investment manager at Killick & Co. Well, executive pay on the stock market back in the spotlight this week, with one FTSE-listed company trying to double the pay of its boss to $14 million. Ashtead, the construction equipment rental firm, said that its success relies on continuing to attract and retain high-calibre talent, including at executive level, who are residents of the United States as well. Gillian Wilmot has plenty of experience on company boards. She's currently the chairman of AIM-listed Zoo Digital as well. Gillian, morning.
Good morning.
We've heard this argument a few times. Does it wash with you that high pay equals attracting talent and turning around some of the issues that's happened in terms of people wanting to invest on the London Stock Exchange, having top bosses at FTSE 100 companies, etc.?
Well, I think the issue here is not about the FTSE 100. It's about the fact that Ashtead does the vast majority of its business in the US. It's a very different business from the one that listed in London in the 80s. And it has a American-based, American-remunerated CEO and execs, and that's the issue. It's a very different business culture and remuneration structure.
Right, so we're talking about international competition.
We're talking about the difference between US and UK business culture, and the remuneration policies in those two markets are entirely different.
Why so?
Because there's just a different culture and a different structure of the way remuneration is done over there, and you have to compete in that market. But a listing is about more than just remuneration. And in the case of Ashtead, they do a huge amount of their business in the US and globally, and it affects other issues, for example, like winning US government contracts. This is a broad issue of which executive pay tends to be a flashpoint.
So you see this as more of a cultural issue, that we perhaps are a little more squeamish in this country, investors a little more squeamish about some of those high pay figures?
We just have a different philosophy. So, for example, in the US, non-execs are encouraged and are given share options, and we don't like that in the UK, and non-execs are not given share options. It's just a whole different way of looking at the world. And it's very difficult for the Remco here, who are trying to put a three-year strategy in place, a three-year policy, and negotiate and speak to investors, which they've clearly been doing. It's incredibly difficult when you've got a London listing and a US executives.
Difficult too, though, isn't it, for these shareholders to have any say, do their jobs properly, really, as investors, you know, in terms of trying to make sure, keep the company honest, you know, in terms of its performance. If pay doubles in one go, you haven't got many sort of incentives, many tools to push back on if you feel performance isn't going well.
Well, we need to sort of separate the issues. I mean, Ashtead's performance is good. And the issue of pay, they're looking forward 3 years. And a lot of these big numbers that you chucked around are around shares, the share options. And they have to meet certain performance standards. Performance is about more than the share price. It's about the return on capital. It's about all those things that reward investors. And proxy agencies are not the same as investment managers.
Gillian, thank you very much for your time this morning as well. Gillian Wilmot there, chairman of the AIM-listed Zoo Digital firm.
Will, thank you very much. Carthy's here now with this morning's sport.
Morning, thank you very much. Leicester City returned to the Premier League last night after just one season away and got a second-half equaliser against Spurs through their energetic 37-year-old striker, Jamie Vardy. The 1-1 draw left the Tottenham manager, Ange Postecoglou, frustrated after their first game of the season.
We're just really wasteful in front of goal, you know. We just didn't take the opportunities before us. We weren't clinical enough. We weren't made some poor decisions and lack composure in the box and around the box. And you know, in a game of football, there's always a danger the opposition will go up once and score, and that's what happened.
Well, with 10 days left of the summer transfer window, Chelsea have agreed a fee in principle for the Athletic Madrid forward João Félix, with Conor Gallagher moving in the other direction as part of that deal. Brighton have completed the signing of the 22-year-old French forward Jorginho Rutter for a club record fee of £40 million from Leeds. Cricket and England have included Matthew Potts in their side for the first test against Sri Lanka, which starts tomorrow at Emirates Old Trafford. The 25-year-old comes in place of the injured captain Ben Stokes, as Henry Moran reports.
We already knew that England would be making at least two changes to their 11, with the hamstring injury to captain Ben Stokes and Zach Crawley's broken finger forcing alterations. Dan Lawrence has been the spare batting option for much of the last 2 years, and he'll open alongside Ben Duckett, whilst there's a return to the side for Durham seamer Matthew Potts, who last played a test in June of 2023. Potts has played six tests prior to this week's series opener, taking 23 wickets. Harry Brook, meanwhile, has been named as vice-captain, and he'll support Ollie Pope, who leads the side for the first time. England go into the series as strong favourites, but the absence of Stokes and Crawley marks a big change from the successful blueprint of the Test side from the last 2 years.
And three British players have made it safely through the first round of qualifying for tennis's US Open, which starts on Monday. British number six Heather Watson beat the 2023 Wimbledon junior champion Claire Vian-Gunaway 6-1, 6-1. Paul Jubb won the all-British encounter against Jacob Fernley. And Stoné Kartál, who reached the third round at Wimbledon this year, is also through to the second round.
Kathy, thank you very much. Let's look ahead now to next week.
How to Play on BBC Radio 4.
You get inside the music and you're getting closer to what you think the composer was trying to say to the world.
Giving the inside view on beloved pieces of music.
It's like a treasure hunt in a way.
The music is more than just the notes.
Peeking into the rehearsal room.
I am the only professional one-handed concert pianist who has a soloist career. You know, it's not for the faint-hearted. We put ourselves through an awful lot of stress to walk out on stage to deliver ice in the veins, for sure.
How to Play on BBC Sounds and Radio 4, next Monday morning at 9:30.
And the time is now just after 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in Chicago, Michelle Hussein in London, Caroline Nichols reading the news.
An emotional Joe Biden has told the Democratic Party's National Convention in Chicago that they're in a battle for the very soul of America. His vice president, Kamala Harris, will be formally confirmed as the party's presidential nominee during the four-day event. Mr. Biden said he would be the best volunteer the Harris campaign could ever have. The search for six people missing after a luxury yacht sank off the coast of Sicily is resuming this morning. Among them, the British technology tycoon Mike Lynch and his 18-year-old daughter Hannah. The 180-foot yacht went down in a storm yesterday. 15 people were rescued, including Mr. Lynch's wife, Angela Bacaras, and a one-year-old British girl. A man's body has been recovered. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is travelling to Egypt as he continues his push for a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza. After talks in Jerusalem yesterday, Mr. Blinken said Israel had accepted what he called a bridging proposal and urged Hamas to do the same. Ukraine's President Zelensky says his forces have seized almost 500 square miles of Russian territory during a two-week incursion across the border. At the same time, Russian forces are closing in on the Ukrainian city of Pokrovsk, prompting further evacuations. A gay British-Mexican man who spent 44 days in prison in Qatar has warned other LGBT people to be careful when visiting the country. Manuel Guerrero Avina was arrested in a police sting operation involving the gay dating app Grindr. He's told the BBC he was targeted for his sexuality, but Qatari officials insist the arrest was solely for drug offences. A rocket engine has exploded during a launch test at the UK's new spaceport in Shetland. The test was carried out by RFA, a German company, which said the data would be analysed with the goal of returning to regular operations as soon as possible. The first £1 coins featuring the king come into circulation this week. Nearly 3 million of the new designs will be making their way into people's pockets and tills across the UK via post offices and banks.
Caroline, thank you very much. It is 6:32 now. Before the riots, His Majesty's Prison Durham had just one spare bed. That is a single example from within a BBC analysis of prison population figures, which helps to explain why emergency contingency measures are now in place. They were announced about this time yesterday. Dominic Casciani, our home and legal correspondent, joins us. And it tells us really, Dominic, just how extreme the position was.
Yes, that's right. I mean, as of last Friday, there was 87,893 people in jails across England and Wales, which is an awful loss. But it left an operating margin of about 1,000 beds, or about 1%. And that 1% was very, very, very quickly eaten into over the course of the weekend as well. So we know that at least 300 people went into prisons last week because of the riots. And when we looked at the prisons closest to where the disorder was, we saw this quite disturbing picture. The Durham situation, where it seemed to have only one bed. Alt Course in Liverpool, it had only seven spaces at the same time that judges were beginning to sentence offenders. Doncaster, nearest to the hotel holding the asylum seekers in Rotherham, it had eight spaces on the eve of the riots. So it was a very, very difficult situation. leading to the triggering of this emergency measure.
So where are we now in terms of what this means for the wider system? And I mean the justice system, not just the prison system. We're going to be hearing from a defence solicitor later on in the programme. But what does it mean for the magistrates' courts and when people see magistrates?
Well, we already know that some offenders are leaving jails early under an existing system put in place by the outgoing Conservative government, and that system will be extended from September. Operation Early Dawn, which began quite literally at dawn yesterday, is managing the flow into the prisons, effectively by holding people back after they've been charged and they're at police custody suites. Now, the normal principle is if you have been charged with a crime and you're being held by the police, you have to be produced at court at the earliest possible opportunity so that you can exercise your right to a bail hearing and the magistrate can be sure you are the person the police say you are. Under this system, it's highly likely in the days to come in Yorkshire, the North East, the North West and most of the Midlands that the courts will have to ring individual police custody suites and say that person is due to appear, we can't take them on until we know there's a prison cell at the other end in case a magistrate needs to remand that person in custody, and then the prison service has got to establish whether that cell is even available. Now, the practical impact of that could be significant problems across the magistrate system. There's an official letter to the solicitors telling them that there may be disruption across the country, and in some cases you may see police having to bail offenders, suspected offenders, because there is nowhere else to put them.
Dominic, thank you very much. Let's turn to the politics of this, because Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, also joins us. And I think it was clear, Henry, from the first moments of this yesterday that there were warnings about how this Operation Early Dawn could only be a short-term measure. But does the government have answers to this wider problem? Not just what Dominic was saying about the knock-on impact on the magistrates' court, but also this wider question of whether we are locking too many people up, whether custody is too often the answer.
Well, there's a funny bit of sequencing here, because when Keir Starmer became Prime Minister, in his initial batch of ministerial appointments, a lot of them were people we expected who'd been in his shadow cabinet or shadow team. One of them wasn't. That was the prisons minister, a man called Lord Timpson, had been just a commoner. James Timpson had been running Timpson, but also had been a prison reform campaigner. And his appointment was widely taken as a sign that Keir Starmer believed that the whole approach to prison should be reformed, that in James Timpson's view, Britain locks too many people up. And the Labour manifesto said that there would be at some point a sentencing review, a look at how people are sentenced and for what crimes. But all of that feels very distant at the moment when you see the Prime Minister yesterday facing questions about how in the very short term his government plans to tackle a really acute problem of prison capacity.
And generally also politically, but obviously often that kind of thing of like not locking people up so much or for so long doesn't go down well with the public.
Potentially, and you know, it's certainly going to be something that Keir Starmer's political team will be looking at about how to land that argument about prison reform if that is the route they go down. I mean, another sort of strange bit of sequencing is that one of the first controversial, perhaps, decisions that Keir Starmer took as Prime Minister, although he'd say it was inevitable given what he inherited, was to release thousands of prisoners earlier in their sentences than currently planned, release some of them after they've served just 40% of their sentences rather than 50%, as is currently the case for this batch of prisoners. Now, that was announced amid some controversy about a week into Keir Starmer's government, but it hasn't taken effect yet. It will begin to take effect in the second week of September and will mean about 5,000 prisoners released over September and October, freeing up more space. So that controversial decision made back then should help to solve this particular problem starting in September and October. But in the meantime, basically as a consequence of the riots over the summer, there's a much more short-term political and policy challenge for this government.
Henry Zeffman and earlier Dominic Casciani, thank you.
22 minutes to 7. Here at the Democrats' convention in Chicago, the subject of Gaza was on the minds of plenty. Demonstrations, of course, outside the convention centre. Hope of progress, though, inside. And America's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, is travelling to Egypt today as he continues his push for a ceasefire and a hostage release deal in Gaza. Let's talk to the BBC's John Donison, who is in Jerusalem. What's happening, John?
Well, Justin, it remains the case that it's only really the United States that is saying a deal is close. We had Antony Blinken saying after his meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday that the Prime Minister had accepted the so-called bridging proposal and the Israeli Prime Minister supported it. But the statement that came from Bibi Netanyahu himself, not so forthcoming. He simply said it was a good and important meeting with Mr. Blinken. And we've had Hamas saying overnight, an official there, Osama Hamdan, saying that Netanyahu accepting an updated proposal raises many ambiguities since it's not what was presented and not what they agreed on. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done when Mr. Blinken goes to Egypt today and then later to Qatar.
Do we know who he's seeing in Egypt and who indeed he'll be seeing in Qatar?
Well, of course, it's the Egyptians and the Qataris who have been mediating with Hamas. We think he's going to be meeting with the Egyptian president, President Sisi, first of all. One of the things he said, though, yesterday was that it was now very important, crucial, that all sides refrain from actions that could escalate tensions. But overnight we had Israel's military saying it had targeted a Hezbollah weapons store in Lebanon, and then Hamas saying that a number of its senior figures were killed in Israeli airstrikes in Gaza yesterday. And of course Hamas also said yesterday they'd been involved in a bomb attack in Tel Aviv on Sunday. So I think where you are, there's no doubt that Joe Biden, Kamala Harris would love to get a deal through while the Democratic Convention is going on, and certainly before the election. But I don't think there's any real feeling that the key players in the region here are working to the same timetable.
John Donison in Jerusalem. Thank you.
22-7. Let's have a look at the papers. And the dominant story across the UK front pages is Mike Lynch and five others being missing after the capsizing and sinking of that yacht off the coast of Sicily. Vindicated tech baron Lynch missing after luxury yacht goes down off Sicily is the Financial Times' headline. The Times saying rescuers are indicating it is unlikely that more survivors will be found. And it seems that Mike Lynch's wife told doctors that she and her husband woke at 4 a.m. to the boat tilting and the sound of shattering glass. The cause thought to be something called a waterspout, a rare but increasingly common phenomenon in the Mediterranean, the Times says. These intense weather events, which appear as whirling columns of air and mist, are tornadoes that are formed over the sea. And the Times also talks about concern about medicanes, Mediterranean hurricanes linked to rising temperatures caused by climate change.
Digital editions of the American papers now mulling over what Joe Biden was saying to the convention here just a couple of hours ago. The Chicago Tribune, we're in Chicago, saying the Democrats celebrated Biden's presidency amid anxiousness over protests. It notes that his decision to end his re-election bid released newfound energy within the party on the protests, which have been taking place outside the convention centre. The paper notes the convention's opening nearly a year and a half in the making marked an anxious time for the city, its leaders, its residents. What organisers portrayed as the largest rally of the week, the march on the DNC, didn't produce the tens of thousands of protesters they had predicted. It's uncertain, the paper says, what that will mean for the rest of the week. And as for the speech itself, the New York Times, the simple headline, America, I gave my best to you, a quote from the speech by Biden. The New York Times says, by turns, forceful and defiant, pointing out that he warned the audience that November's election was an existential fight for democracy.
I feel I should give Ice Lollies another mention after they got a very brief mention in the earlier paper review, because there's pretty much a full page devoted to it in The Guardian. Essentially, there is a government, this is for England, a curriculum and assessment review underway. And so a group of scientists have done a whole series of recommendations for what should be on the primary school curriculum. And they have said licking an ice lolly should be an essential part of the national curriculum for primary school children. Not only does it taste nice, it teaches the children vital scientific concepts such as heating and cooling and how temperature works. Primary school pupils should also have the opportunity to knead dough, dig in soil, plant vegetables and play with shadows as part of their early science education. They're all essential experiences, according to the scientists. So that's the slightly fuller picture around the ice lolly.
17 minutes to 7, the main headline this morning. An emotional Joe Biden has delivered a farewell speech to his Democratic Party's convention, urging activists to back Kamala Harris to keep Donald Trump out of the White House.
Now, the search for the tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch and five other people still missing after the sinking of a yacht off the coast of Sicily is resuming this morning. The yacht, the Bayesian, is said to have been moored only 300 metres offshore when it was hit by a waterspout and it then capsized. Matthew Shank is chair of the Maritime Search and Rescue Council. It promotes good training and research on safety in this field, and he also used to work at the Italian Coast Guard. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning.
What were your first thoughts when you heard about this?
Concern, really, obviously for the people on board, but also for the safety of these vessels. You know, this is a very advanced, modern commercial vessel, and to suffer such a catastrophic failure and subsequent sinking is a real concern.
Well, do you think that the fact that it's got a particularly tall mast or had a particularly tall mast is relevant?
Yes. So hearing the eyewitness accounts of the vessel heeling, or you know, going over all the way to the waterline with the mast, obviously indicates that there is there's a lot of windage area there. So even though the sails were more than likely stowed, the actual mast and the other equipment on board the vessel above the waterline almost in itself acts like a sail, especially with it being so high. So as the wind picked up either through the waterspout or through the extreme weather that occurred, that's obviously impacted on the vessel's angle that it sits in the water, which is by the accounts has pushed the vessel over to the waterline.
Do you think there are any questions for the authorities in this field about, you know, whether there should have been a weather warning? I don't know whether it is possible to predict these. A waterspout sounds like an almost freak occurrence, but it's not unknown, especially in an age of climate change. Is this the kind of thing that is part of weather warnings?
Sure. So there were weather warnings out for that evening for intense thunderstorms. And there is always the consideration of extreme events in those kind of warnings, such as waterspouts. However, they are still incredibly rare weather events. You know, we have to consider how we could forecast for them. And even if we did forecast, what actual precautions a captain or a crew would make to prepare themselves for these. They're not as common as other weather events. And I think it's important just to consider what we would do in the event of a warning for this and if they can be accurately predicted.
So currently they can't then?
I believe from a meteorological perspective, there can be predictions and models and everything else done with it. And we are aware of where waterspouts can occur in the world. They do occur in the Mediterranean. But again, given the rarity of these events, there really isn't much, I think, the captains or the crew could really do to over-prepare or prepare for these kind of events, given how significant and rare they are.
I wonder about the rescue side of this. This boat was not far out to sea. It was only 300 metres moored offshore.
Yes. So my understanding is that the emergency was first noted by other vessels that were in the anchorage around the vessel that sank. There was a red flare that was put up into the sky to indicate the vessel was in distress. And I believe that there were boats and other resources on scene pretty quickly who obviously affected the rescue of 15 people from the life raft. The reports are that the people who were in the life raft had actually entered the life raft from the water. And that indicates to me that obviously this emergency has happened very, very quickly. People haven't had enough time to enter the life raft from the vessel. They've had to enter from the water.
So does that mean that red flare would have gone up from the life raft rather than from the boat, that possibly this happened to the boat too fast to even put up a flare?
Yes, that's my understanding, is that the flare has been fired from the life raft, according to the reports. We don't know if the vessel had time to send out any electronic distress signals, if it used its radio or its other equipment to alert the authorities. But the eyewitness accounts from the anchorage and the shore state, they saw the red flare, and actually one of the skippers, one of the captains from the anchorage, said that he saw the vessel 1 minute and the next minute the vessel was gone, and all he saw was the red flare, which indicates to me that this has been a catastrophic incident which has gone very quickly.
Matthew Shank from the Maritime Search and Rescue Council, thank you.
It is 12 minutes to 7. Here in Chicago, they have kicked off the Democratic Convention. Joe Biden, the main speaker. Emma Vardy reports now on night number one of the political jamboree that might just launch Kamala Harris towards the White House.
There was a surprise early appearance on stage from the Democrat headline act.
Good evening, good evening.
And Kamala Harris got a rock star's welcome ahead of her star turn later in the week. It's less than a month since Joe Biden pulled out of the race, and in a short space of time, Kamala Harris has rejuvenated the party.
This November, we will come together and declare with one voice, as one people, we are moving forward.
The US president, who had been poised to fight a second term, instead took to the stage to pass on the torch.
Kamala and Tim understand that this nation must continue to be a place of possibilities. I promise I'll be the best volunteer Harris and Waltz has Cam have ever seen.
Joe Biden attacked Donald Trump's vision for the future and said America is now at a moral crossroads.
You've heard me say it before. We're facing an inflection point. One of those rare moments in history when the decisions we make now will determine the fate of our nation and the world. We're in a battle for the very soul of America.
The arena is packed to capacity for this moment. People are being turned away at the door, and you can feel the warmth in the crowd for Joe Biden. Democrats who were once in despair about his failings are tonight full of appreciation. And what we're watching right now is essentially Joe Biden's goodbye. There was a standing ovation for Hillary Clinton, who fought and lost to Donald Trump in 2016 and knows what it's like to be on the end of his personal attacks.
So it is no surprise, is it, that he is lying about Kamala's record? He's mocking her name and her laugh. Sounds familiar.
Polling indicates Kamala Harris is now leading Donald Trump in key battleground states. But Hillary Clinton warned the party not to be complacent.
We have him on the run now. No matter what the polls say, we can't let up.
Outside the arena, tens of thousands of people marched over the war in Gaza, protesting against Joe Biden's support for Israel. Inside, it featured only briefly, as a popular left-wing congresswoman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, called for a ceasefire.
And she is working tirelessly to secure a ceasefire in Gaza and bringing hostages home.
She will fight for every woman and every girl, even those who are not fighting for her.
One of the most emotive and divisive issues for America also featured in many speeches. Kamala Harris has made a woman's right to an abortion a central part of her campaign.
Trump's actions have resulted in extreme bans on abortion, even in cases of rape, incest, and non-viable pregnancies. That fails any test of humanity.
Voters are still getting to know Kamala Harris, and this week is seen as an opportunity for her to reintroduce herself to the country. Her nomination has turned the presidential race on its head, and Democrats are thoroughly enjoying it.
Emma Vardy reporting from Chicago. It is 8 minutes to seven. Doctors in India are continuing to take part in a national strike in protest at the rape and murder of a colleague, a young woman who was resting in an empty room at her hospital in Kolkata when she was attacked. Her family had pinned their hopes of a better life onto her training and bright future. And her father has revealed in an interview with the BBC just what they are going through. To protect the family's identity, his words have been voiced by one of our colleagues.
We come from a lower class background and we built up everything by ourselves. And suddenly now, at the age of 62, all my dreams have been shattered. We want the harshest punishment for this. Our state, our country, even the whole world is asking for justice. And I'm mentioning the role of the hospital because whenever she used to leave for work, we would remain tense until she called and informed us that she had reached the hospital safely. Only then we would feel relieved. But the hospital is the place where something so barbaric happened to her while on duty. All of our relatives and neighbors used to tell me, you managed to make your daughter a doctor only by running a tailoring shop. And I used to say, no, I did not make her, but she became a doctor through her own hard work. We just provided some support. The effort was all hers.
And on the line now is the president of the Indian Medical Association, Dr. R.V. Asokan, who we spoke to first on the programme on Saturday and who's with us now from his hospital in Kerala. Dr. Asokan, what is the response from the government that would give you the safety assurances that would make all doctors in India go back to work?
Well, the union government is reluctant to concede the central act. They are pointing out there are 25 state laws and which is adequate. It is our experience that this is inadequate because after hundreds of cases of hospital attacks, barely there are one or two convictions. What happened in Calcutta is qualitatively different, and the hospital has suddenly become unsafe for women doctors especially. And it's a crime that has taken place. So apart from a deterrent central law, we also require by law mandatory security protocols in all the large hospitals across the country.
You are therefore looking for a response from the central government, the union government, and they seem to be saying that it's a matter for individual states in India. Are hospitals not able to put the kinds of security measures that you are asking for in place themselves?
Most of the tertiary hospitals in private sector have a security protocol in place. This is more about medical colleges, 706 medical colleges exactly. And both in government and private medical colleges, the private hospitals, the hospital, medical college hospitals have to have a security protocol. And our demand is that, yes, we need a declaration that hospitals are safe zones.
But isn't the issue much wider than hospitals, the issue that has been underlined in such stark terms by what happened to this young woman on the brink of a career in your field, which is just about the safety of women in all kinds of walks of life and not even necessarily professional walks of life, the young women that India needs to go out and work.
Exactly. That is the point we are making. Now, fortunately, we have this Indian Medical Association, which can stand up for not only the women doctors, but for the women of India, for them to go out, work, and be in any space they want.
And if you don't get the central government response you want, is it not possible for your demands to be met by the different states?
I think states would be ready. There is an enabling law that the central government can take with the consent of the states. It is possible if the political will is there. So we are just waiting for that political will to develop in the central government.
Dr. R.V. Asokan from the Indian Medical Association. Thank you.
3 minutes to seven. Thomas Schaffernacker has the weather. Morning again, Thomas.
No, good morning again. Yes, a very blustery day on the way today across the northern half of the UK in particular. Also heavy showers sweeping in and plenty have already done so. Currently, the really blustery weather is across Lancashire and parts of the Lake District. Also in the south of Wales, some really heavy rain in places with those gusts of wind. So I think for the rest of the morning and into the afternoon, it's pretty much what it's going to be across the north of the UK. Showers and those strong winds and the temperatures at times, temperatures only around about 15 or 16 degrees in those strong gusts of wind. Now, further south across the country, it's going to be a better picture, although showers are expected too. The best of the sunshine will be around the North Sea coasts, the Channel coast, the Midlands, East Anglia and the southeast. And here in the sunshine, it'll be warmest too, with temperatures approaching the low to mid 20s, but coastal areas will be a little bit cooler. That takes us into the forecast for tonight. The winds will ease, but not completely. It'll still be quite breezy overnight. Morning temperatures early on Wednesday will be around 10 to 12 degrees. And then an outlook for Wednesday itself. Again, it's the northern half of the UK in for a very windy and wet picture, especially Northern Ireland, the northwest of England and also Scotland. And really, that is the outlook for the rest of the week. At times, it's going to be very windy. In fact, we have the remnants of an ex-hurricane on the way. But don't worry, won't be quite so windy, but we'll certainly feel it in the northwest of the UK. Back to you.
Thomas, thank you very much.
On BBC iPlayer.
We are not in control of this situation.
We know that these shootings are very upsetting for the community.
It's a gathering storm and I'm worried about anyone who's at the centre of it.
There will be consequences.
A misculture or code of not grassing, we are way beyond that now.
They're all turning on each other. This ends before it begins.
Revenge runs in the family. I go down, you go down.
Blood for blood.
Put them down.
We've been in danger before.
But this is different, Rory. Look at me. This is different.
Sherwood, Series 2.
It's on a knife edge out there.
Start Sunday on BBC iPlayer.
In the next hour on this programme, he was angry, he was passionate, he was very, very well received by the audience, but he was doing it all after prime time was over on national television, at least in the east of the country. We examine what Joe Biden has been telling his convention.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 from London and Chicago. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 20th of August. The headlines this morning: the outgoing US President Joe Biden has endorsed Kamala Harris as his successor in a passionate defence of his record at the Democratic Party's National Convention. Searches are resuming off Sicily for six people, including the British tech tycoon Mike Lynch, after their yacht capsized more than 24 hours ago. And a rocket engine has exploded during testing at the UK's new spaceport in Shetland. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nicholls.
An emotional Joe Biden has told Democratic supporters that they're in a battle for the very soul of America. The outgoing president was addressing the party's national convention in Chicago in a speech at times drowned out by chants of "Thank you, Joe." The four-day event will confirm his vice president Kamala Harris as the Democratic presidential candidate to take on Donald Trump. From Chicago, our North America editor Sarah Smith has this report.
Joe Biden was cheered to the rafters as he arrived on stage by a party that was, in effect, saying goodbye to him. During more than 4.5 minutes of sustained applause, some of his supporters had tears in their eyes, and it looked like he did too. Running through his achievements in office, he was able to list record job creation, massive spending on infrastructure, a gun safety law, and he proclaimed that despite the Russian invasion, Ukraine is still free. He also said he wasn't finished yet.
I've got 5 months left in my presidency. I've got a lot to do. I intend to get it done. It's been the honor of my lifetime to serve as your president. I love the job, but I love my country more.
It must have been very bittersweet to have his party celebrating him so loudly because he agreed to step aside, congratulating him on his achievements because he's handing over to a younger candidate. President Biden knows the best way to cement his legacy and what he managed to get done as president is to get Kamala Harris elected as his successor. And he said he would be the best volunteer the Harris campaign could ever have.
The search for six people missing after a luxury yacht sank off the coast of Sicily is resuming this morning. Among them are the British technology tycoon Mike Lynch and his daughter. The 180-foot yacht went down in a storm yesterday. 15 people were rescued, including Mr. Lynch's wife, Angela Bacares, and a one-year-old British girl. A man's body has been recovered. From Sicily, our correspondent Mark Lowen reports.
More names are emerging of those engulfed by the sea as their superyacht, the Baesian, capsized here in Porticello. As well as the tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch and his 18-year-old daughter Hannah, Sicily's civil protection says Jonathan Bloomer, the chairman of the investment bank Morgan Stanley International, and Chris Morvillo, a lawyer for Mr. Lynch, are among the six passengers still missing. We watched as diver rescue teams returned to shore late last night, with the operation set to resume this morning. It's thought likely that bodies will be found trapped on the seabed in the wreckage of the Baysian, which was hit by a waterspout, a tornado-like column of cloud and water that snapped the mast, with the yacht quickly swallowed up by the waves.
2 months ago, Mike Lynch was acquitted in the US of fraud charges related to the sale of the software company Autonomy to the American IT giant Hewlett-Packard. It's emerged that his co-defendant, Stephen Chamberlain, has died after being hit by a car in Cambridgeshire on Saturday. A lawyer for Mr. Chamberlain, who was also cleared, said he'd been fatally injured while out running. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is travelling to Egypt as he continues his push for a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza. After talks in Jerusalem yesterday, Mr. Blinken said Israel had accepted what he called a bridging proposal and urged Hamas to do the same. More from our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison.
Antony Blinken says he got what he came for in Israel. He says Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accepts and supports the so-called bridging proposal towards a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza. The US Secretary of State now heads to Egypt and Qatar to try to get them to put pressure on Hamas to do the same. But the Islamist group has called US talk of progress an illusion, and at least publicly, there is little sign that either Hamas or Israel is committed to a deal. Mr. Blinken said it was crucial that everyone refrain from actions that would escalate tensions. Overnight, Israel's military says it targeted a Hezbollah weapons store in Lebanon, and Hamas says a number of its senior figures were killed in Israeli airstrikes in Gaza yesterday. It also claimed to have been involved in a bomb attack in Tel Aviv on Sunday.
A community in southern Israel has announced the death of a hostage being held in Gaza. The statement from kibbutz near Oz said Avraham Munda, who was 79, was the victim of months of physical and mental torture. Israeli media say his wife, daughter and grandson were also held hostage, but were released as part of a swap deal last November. Thousands of Rohingya Muslims have fled to Bangladesh in the past 2 weeks after facing violence again in Myanmar. The BBC has gathered evidence of a particularly deadly attack on the 5th of August, in which scores of fleeing Rohingyas were bombed, they say by a rebel group. Our South Asia correspondent, Yogitila Moye, has sent this report from Bangladesh.
Boats filled with Rohingyas have been arriving in Bangladesh over the past 2 weeks. The surge began after an attack on the 5th of August. Survivors and eyewitnesses of the bombing have told the BBC that they were attacked by the insurgent Arakan Army, a group that's fighting against Myanmar's military in the country's civil war. The group has said it has no connection with the attack. Videos of the aftermath of the bombing have been verified by the BBC. They show dozens of dead, a significant number of them women and children. The accusations raise serious questions for the Arakan Army, which has projected itself as a resistance group fighting on behalf of the people against the military junta.
A gay British-Mexican man who spent 44 days in prison in Qatar has warned other LGBT people to be careful when visiting the country. Manuel Guerrero Avina was arrested in a police sting involving the gay dating app Grindr. He's told the BBC he was targeted for his sexuality, and international human rights organisations have raised concerns about the case. Qatari officials insist the arrest was solely for drug offences. More details from our LGBT and identity reporter Josh Parry.
Until February, Manuel Guerrero Avina had spent 7 years in Qatar. Although homosexuality is illegal in the country, he claimed there was an unwritten rule that what happened in private would go unpunished. However, after arranging to meet a man he'd been messaging online, who later turned out to be part of an undercover police operation, he was arrested and later convicted of drug offences. Mr. Guerrero Avina, who is now back in the UK, believes his arrest was motivated by his sexuality.
If this was a drug case, they would be asking, you know, where did you get the, the substances that they claim they are mine. But the full interrogation was about sexual partners and my sexual preferences.
Qatari officials told the BBC Mr. Guerrero Avina was arrested for possessing an illegal substance and that no other factors were considered when making the arrest. They said Mr. Guerrero Avina and his family have made what they called numerous false allegations in an attempt to generate public sympathy for his case.
A rocket engine has exploded during a test at Britain's new spaceport in Shetland. The test was carried out by a German company, RFA, who hope eventually to send the UK's first vertical rocket into orbit. 3 months ago, its first test at the Saxavord spaceport on the island of Unst was declared a success. Our Scotland correspondent, Lorna Gordon, was watching in Shetland.
The full nine-engine ground-based test was part of a number of trials due to be carried out before RFA progressed to launching its rockets into space. A small crowd had gathered across a bay from the spaceport to watch. Large flames and plumes of smoke could initially be seen shooting horizontally from the side of the rocket, and there were loud bangs as the entire structure was then engulfed by fire. In a statement, Saxavord Spaceport said all safety protocols were fully observed and the site was evacuated prior to the test, leaving no staff at risk. RFA said the data they had gathered would be analysed and their goal would be to return to regular operations as soon as possible.
Lorna Gordon reporting.
Thank you. 9 minutes past seven. Joe Biden wanted the job himself. He wanted to carry on as president, to fight the next election, to see off Donald Trump, and as he saw it, to rescue democracy. But here in Chicago, just an hour or two ago, he found himself speaking as very much the warm-up act on the opening day of an event that is no longer in his control. In fact, he was pushed back to a slot that was, by the time they got to it, not even in prime time on television. He gave it his all, though, something he said he had always done.
Like many of you, I've given my heart and soul to our nation. And I've been blessed a million times in return for the support of the American people. I've either been too young to be in the Senate because I wasn't 30 yet, and too old to stay as president. But I hope you know how grateful I am to all of you.
Wasn't an easy speech to make. It needed to balance talking up of his presidency with a proper sense of respect for the woman who has replaced him on the ticket.
She's tough. She's experienced. And she has enormous integrity, enormous integrity. Her story represents the best American story. And like many of our best presidents, she was also vice president. That's a joke.
Let's talk to Sarah Smith, our North America editor, who was watching it all. No doubt, Sarah, at all, was there about the affection, the genuine affection that came from those watching to him, particularly when he started.
Oh, absolutely. It was really, really emotional on the floor of the convention. Almost 5 minutes of applause as he came on stage, and he looked really, really moved by that as well. And you had the sense that you were about to watch quite a significant political moment. I mean, he was effectively saying goodbye, even though he's got 5 months left in his presidency. And this was the opportunity for his party to say thank you to him for over 50 years of elected public service, as well as of his one term as president. And so there was a very high expectation. And I'm sorry to say, I just don't think the speech measured up. It was a pretty boilerplate recitation of the things he has achieved in office. And by the time he got to the end of it, he was praising Kamala Harris, as you heard there, but he didn't sound like a man who was happy to hand over the reins, to be perfectly honest. He did say that he loved the job as president, but he just loved his country more. And I just didn't think he gave the sense of having actually come to terms with the idea that he was pushed aside effectively for a younger candidate because his party felt he was too old, voters thought he was too old to carry on. It was dignified, but it wasn't a particularly gracious way of saying goodbye, I didn't think.
Yeah, it's a fascinating point, that, isn't it? We're going to hear from Anita Dunn later in the programme, who was his very senior advisor in the White House, who says that she still believes, actually, he could have won. He could have stayed and he could have won. And she sort of says that maybe he still believes it too. And you did get that impression, didn't you, from the speech?
Yeah, you got the sense that he was not at ease with the decision that he feels that he was pushed into. Kamala Harris herself made a surprise appearance shortly before him, and she was full of praise for Joe Biden and the amazing job he'd done. He didn't, as he was running through all of the things that he's achieved in office, all of the important pieces of legislation that have been passed, he wasn't weaving her role in that through this story. It wasn't as though he was telling this tale in a way that he was handling handing the reins over to her. She came on stage at the very end, and there was a moment when they embraced, where you could see it was a visual demonstration of the baton being passed from Joe Biden to a younger generation to a new candidate. And that was quite an affecting moment when you saw it there. But yeah, the speech was not infused with that sense, I wouldn't say.
Sarah Smith, thank you.
13 minutes past seven now. What are the problems with keeping suspects in police custody rather than sending them to prison, as is happening under Operation Early Dawn? The Law Society, which represents solicitors in England and Wales, says a summons to the magistrate's court will happen only when it is confirmed that a cell in the prison estate is ready for someone, should they be remanded into custody. Of course, they might not be at that appearance before magistrates. But people will be held in a police station until that summons, and many magistrates' cases, the Law Society says, will be delayed. Kerry Morgan is a Manchester-based solicitor at Morgan, Brown & Company, and she has clients affected by this. Good morning, Kerry.
Good morning.
Give us an example, then, of what this situation means for your clients.
Well, it means that a client that's arrested one day would usually have to appear under the Police and Criminal Evidence Act at the police at the court within the next available opportunity, which is usually the next day or the same day. But what's happening now is that offenders are being held back at the police station because there is no prison space for them to go to if they appeared in court and got remanded in custody.
Because you have to have a prison space available for that hearing to take place in case they get remanded into custody.
That seems to be the idea behind it, but not everybody who the police refuse bail for in a police station gets kept in custody when they appear in court.
So it means that not getting to the magistrate's court reduces your chances of getting someone bail which a magistrate might readily agree to.
Yes. And when somebody's remanded in custody at the police station, the police have made a decision that they don't want that person to be given bail or to be released from custody. But some people appear in court, are sentenced, some people are released on bail. Yesterday I had an example of somebody who had been held back at the police station because the police had refused them bail, eventually got them to court and they got a conditional discharge. So they would never have needed a prison space.
So they won't get that opportunity, or they won't get that opportunity as quickly under this system because they just won't get to court as quickly?
No, they're being deprived of the checks and balances that the court system puts in there to check whether the decisions made by the police are correct.
And is that within the rules? Because I hear this point about the rule is that you have to be taken to court at the earliest possible opportunity.
It's the next available sitting of the court. The Police Federation actually wrote an open letter in June 2024, confirmed that they'd had advice that to keep them in police cells without putting them before the next available court was actually unlawful and false imprisonment.
But what's the time frame? Because, of course, the next available sitting, I mean, there is no time frame attached to that in the rules, is there?
Well, it should be. If there is a court available, that person should be appearing before it. Now, the fact is there is a court available. There's just not a prison space for that person to go in if they get remanded in custody.
So what are you calling for then?
Well, we think that people should appear in court as normal. They should appear before the court. If there isn't a prison space for them to go to, then by all means, put them back in police cells, but don't deprive people of having that chance of appearing before the court to check whether the decision to keep them in custody by the police is the correct one.
And that would mean changing the current system, wouldn't it? So you'd want them to appear in court as normal. Even if there's no prison space, the court appearance should go ahead.
Yes.
But what if the court does then want to remand the person in custody? They go back to the police cell.
Then if there isn't a prison space for them, put them in the police cells. Don't keep the police cells full of people who may well be innocent or may be bail candidates, because we're just clogging up police cells and people aren't being arrested because there's nowhere to put them if they commit an offence.
So you've got clients in a police cell now who you think if they got to a magistrate's court might well get out on bail?
Very possibly.
Because you think that The magistrate would just look at the case differently to the police?
Yes, I mean, if you think of the number of people that actually get refused bail at the police station by the police, I would say only probably 50% of those actually get kept in by the court. The court's there for checks and balances so that you can present your case to them and decide whether or not somebody is a suitable candidate for bail or to be sentenced.
Kerry Morgan, thank you very much. We will have a minister with us in about an hour's time. The Ministry of Justice, in the meantime, has said that Operation Early Dawn manages the movement of those between police stations and the courts, and that it ensures all statutory duties are met.
18 minutes past seven. The price of gold has hit record levels in recent days. Why? Will is here to tell us.
Yeah, I'm going to try to, Justin. Gold prices, as you say, reaching all-time highs, breaking $2,500 an ounce through the weekend, with expectations it could climb higher still. Rona O'Connell is head of market analysis for Europe, Middle East and Africa, as well as Asia, of the financial services firm StoneX. She's also the deputy chair of the Public Affairs Committee at the London Bullion Market Association. They set the standards for the gold market. Rona, morning.
Good morning, Will.
What is behind this then? Try and explain it for us.
I'll do my best. There's a combination probably of four key elements. The first one is the interest rate cycle, obviously, which has been commanding attention through the financial sector for many months now. And that obviously is tied in with inflationary forces. A point I would want to make here is that historically, gold has been seen as the key inflation hedge. If you're a professional investor, that's not really the case, because a much better inflation hedge would be what's called the TIPS, which is the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities in the United States. But obviously, because of the way interest rates and inflation work together, there is a driving element there. The next one is geopolitics. And by that, I don't just mean tensions in, for example, the Middle East, Ukraine, or in any other international conflicts. The other important element of geopolitics here is the number of general elections that we've got and regional elections over the course of 2024, with over half of the world's electorate available to vote. The official sector, i.e. central banks and supranational organisations, has been very important because they've been big buyers of gold over the last 3 years or so. And it's not just a question of taking tonnage off the market. It's more of a key element is the signal that by doing so, they're sending a message to the rest of the markets that they're concerned about instability, be it financial or political or both. And the fourth one, which is one of my big hobby horses as a market analyst, is the stresses in the banking sector. Mm. And we've had a good example very recently with a small American bank being challenged by the regulators for being overexposed.
And a little later this week, just further west of Justin in Jackson Hole, we're going to get central bank governors meeting from Federal Reserve in the US, and that will map out the interest rate picture again. Could that potentially drive the price higher again?
It could. All eyes will, of course, be on Fed Chair Jay Powell. He's unlikely to give away too much because we have an important Federal Reserve meeting about 4 weeks away. But if he says anything to do with the weakening in the labour market in the States, which is the key element that they're looking at now, then that could certainly bake in even further the expectations for a 50 basis point cut in the mid-September meeting.
Rona O'Connell from the financial services firm StoneX, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you. 21 minutes past seven. The European Space Agency has a craft called JUICE on a mission to Jupiter. It's got a long way to go, and something had to happen overnight to help get it there. Let's talk to Dr. Caroline Harper, who's head of space science at the UK Space Agency. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What had to happen, and did it happen?
Well, some of it happened. So JUICE flew by the moon last night, very close. It got really close, about 700 kilometers from the moon, and it's now heading towards Earth for a close flyby of Earth as well. So this is a double flyby, lunar Earth flyby, that's never been done before because it's a very risky procedure. And that what it does is it adjusts the speed and the trajectory of the spacecraft and sends it on a very convoluted pathway towards towards Jupiter. You would think, wouldn't you, that it would be a straight line would be the most efficient way to get there, just go in a straight line from here to Jupiter, but that's not the case. And counterintuitively, if we go on a sort of a scenic route and use the gravity of the moon and Earth, and then it'll be Venus next, this is actually more efficient, saves a lot of fuel. So it's wending its way now around Earth.
So that's the point, is it? That it's getting kind of thrust from using what? The gravitational pull? Hello, Dr. Harper, are you there? Oh, dear. She's gone, I hope not into deep space, but she's gone somewhere.
Yes, unfortunately, maybe we'll try and get her back, but did sound rather definitive that. 23 minutes past seven. We can go to Sicily, though, now, because the tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch is still missing, along with five others, after his yacht capsized. He was beginning what he called his second life after seeing the end of a US legal ordeal, and he had taken, it seems, colleagues and supporters on holiday when that yacht, the Bayesian, capsized and then sank. Our Italy correspondent, Mark Lowen, is in Porticello in Sicily. Just close to there was where the yacht was moored. What do we know about the search, Mark?
Morning, Michelle. Well, the search resumed at 6:30 in the morning local time, with divers trying to access the wreckage of the Bayesian luxury superyacht, which is sitting at about 50 metres underwater on the seabed. We watched on the port last night as diving teams returned to the port because, of course, overnight and with no natural light, they would have struggled to make any progress. We also understand that they were hampered in trying to get access to the cabins during the search on the first day because of furniture that from the ship that had been strewn around after this storm. Now, the Italian media has named the six missing as Mike Lynch, as you mentioned, the British tech entrepreneur, his 18-year-old daughter, Hannah, the lawyer, one of the lawyers from Mr. Lynch in his US legal ordeals, Chris Morvillo from Clifford Chance, and his wife, Nada. The president of Morgan Stanley International, Jonathan Bloomer, and his wife, Anne. They are also saying that the one body that was recovered from the water yesterday was the chef of the yacht, Ricardo Thomas, who is Canadian-born.
Do we know yet from the authorities how quickly they think the yacht went down? Because we were talking to an expert earlier on who said it's now seems pretty clear that the flare that went up that enabled the rescue of people who were on the life raft went up from the life raft, not from the boat.
Yes, indeed. And when the flare went up, the yacht had already gone down. I mean, it was engulfed by the waves very quickly, according to eyewitnesses, according to local fishermen, and according to a captain who rescued the 15 people on that life on that lifeboat. There was actually a weather alert that had been in place in this area for 4 days, we understand from local meteorologists, following intense heat in recent days, storms and heavy rainfall that had raised the temperature of the Mediterranean to 30 degrees. That is about 3 notches higher than normal, and therefore had sort of amplified the risk of extreme weather. And that, it appears, Michelle, was the cause behind this water spout, a tornado-like spiral, a rotating column of air and water that engulfed the Bayesian superyacht and broke its mast, its 76-metre-high aluminium mast, the highest in the world. It snapped, forcing the boat to capsize, and therefore it was engulfed within the water within a matter of seconds.
Mark Lowen in Porticello, Sicily. Thank you.
26 minutes past seven to the sport. Here's Carthy.
Thank you. A couple of football headlines to start. Leicester City returned to the Premier League last night after just one season away and got a second-half equaliser against Spurs through their 37-year-old striker, Jamie Vardy, won all the final score. Brighton have completed the signing of the 22-year-old French forward, Jorginho Rutter, for a club record fee of £40 million from Leeds. And there are just 10 days left of the summer transfer window. Chelsea have agreed a fee in principle for the Atletico Madrid forward, João Félix, with Conor Gallagher moving in the other direction as part of that deal. Now, you may remember a recent YouGov poll showed that more than a quarter of the British public thought they could qualify for the 2028 Olympics if they started training for a sport today. That may have caused amusement amongst current Olympic athletes, including the two-time Olympic champion Andy Murray. But UK Sport is launching a campaign, Find Your Greatness, to identify future Team GB or Paralympics GB stars. I'm very pleased to say we can speak to Dan Powell, a Paralympic judoka and world silver medalist. Thanks for joining us, Dan. It's a week to go until the Paralympics. Is the wait in between the Olympics and the Paralympics quite difficult to manage mentally?
Yeah, it is a little bit. I think all the sort of pressure around the Paralympics starting really does start building at this point. You know, even the support from other people as well. You know, you get people asking, "Oh, when are you flying out? When's the opening ceremony?" You know, everyone's that that sort of pressure cooker really starts, you know, and because people know it's the next big sporting event.
Yeah, and this campaign isn't to belittle your achievements in any way. You're a world silver medalist, a Commonwealth Games champion. This is about making sport more accessible. Your father, who's also registered blind, won bronze at the Paralympics, I think, in Seoul and Atlanta. But what are the main barriers of people who perhaps don't have that kind of connection to sport?
Yeah, you know, like me growing up and seeing my dad leaving our house, like wearing his GB tracksuit, was one of the first things that inspired me to want to be an athlete. You know, I've got a little boy now myself, and that's, you know, the one thing my little boy, you know, every time I come home from an event and, you know, if I've medaled or even if I've just brought him back a teddy bear from the other side of the world, you know, he's made up and the smile on his face makes it all worth it. So, you know, yeah, it's I know there's some barriers out there, especially when it comes to Paralympic sport as well. But, you know, I think the biggest thing is around attitude, and, you know, having that gold medal winning attitude is what you need to be an athlete.
Well, as I mentioned, there was some amusement about the YouGov poll with people feeling that they could train and get to an Olympics in 4 years' time or a Paralympics. But athletes like Helen Glover, Lizzie Arnold, Emma Wiggs have achieved Olympic and Paralympic success through discovering that they have the right attributes for competing in sport a little later in life. But can you explain a bit about the dedication that it takes, the training and the hours a day and what you have to put into it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I do think it's amazing the optimism that the people taking this poll has, you know, and fair play. You know, if people really do, I'd really love someone to go out there and show it, you know, and it takes so much pain and training and like dedication to go and try and complete this goal of just competing at an Olympic or Paralympic Games. You know, myself as an athlete, you know, I've been competing since 2010 internationally, and I don't know how I'm still knocking around at this point to be honest, but you know, it's I absolutely love competing and flying around the world, and you've got to enjoy training and what you do, because it's too hard otherwise. You know, you can't turn up every day with a smile on your face. You know, you've just got to try and find a way of enjoying it.
Yeah, well, I think you're going to be putting people through their paces today, giving them a try at judo. Good luck with that, and thank you very much for joining us. Good luck at the Paralympics as well next week, Dan Powell. Just a tennis line to finish, and three British players have made it safely through the first round of qualifying for the US Open. The British number six, Heather Watson, beat the 2023 Wimbledon champion, Clairvin Gunaway. Paul Jubb won the all-British encounter against Jacob Fernley, and Sonny Cartel, who you may remember that name, she reached the third round at Wimbledon this year, and she is also through to the second round of qualifying in New York.
Thank you very much, Cathy.
On BBC Radio 4.
I think a soggy bottom is a sign of a good time.
Do you need help perfecting your beef Wellington, or are you on the hunt for the ultimate hot sauce recipe?
So you get a sourness, you get a heat, you get sweet, you get hot, you get everything. Reduce it down, then add a little more rum at the end.
Fear not, for my hungry panel are here to devour your questions, offer up inspiration and dish out some advice of their own.
The back of the plane is more enjoyable for an eating experience because there's more moisture in the air, because there's more bodies, as opposed to first class. So I recommend going economy.
The Kitchen Cabinet with me, Jay Rayner, on Saturday mornings at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
To the weather. Most of the UK seeing sunny spells and patchy cloud, few showers as well, most frequent and locally heavy in the north, a risk of thunder.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 from London and Chicago this morning, and where Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
An emotional Joe Biden has told Democrats they're battling for the very soul of America in a passionate defence of his record in office. The outgoing president was addressing the party's national convention in Chicago in a speech at times drowned out by chants of "Thank you, Joe." The four-day event will confirm his vice president, Kamala Harris, as the Democratic presidential candidate to take on Donald Trump. The search for six people missing after a luxury yacht sank off the coast of Sicily is resuming. Among them are the British technology tycoon Mike Lynch and his 18-year-old daughter. The 180-foot yacht went down in a storm early yesterday morning. 15 people were rescued and a man's body has been recovered. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is travelling to Egypt as he continues his push for a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza. After talks in Jerusalem yesterday, Mr. Blinken said Israel had accepted what he called a bridging proposal and urged Hamas to do the same. A community in southern Israel has announced the death of a hostage being held in Gaza. The statement from kibbutz near Oz said 79-year-old Avraham Munda was the victim of months of physical and mental torture. Israeli media say his wife, daughter and grandson were also held hostage, but were released as part of a truce last November. A rocket engine has exploded during a test at Britain's new spaceport in Shetland. The test was carried out by a German company, Rocket Factory Augsburg, who hope eventually to send the UK's first vertical rocket into orbit. RFA said the data would be analysed with the goal of returning to regular operations as soon as possible. The first £1 coins featuring the king come into circulation this week. Nearly 3 million of the new designs will be making their way into people's pockets and tills across the UK via post offices and banks.
Thank you. It is 27 minutes to eight. Might the Gaza conflict do real damage to the Democrats here in Chicago? It is quite likely that there will be protests inside the convention hall and during the day. Yesterday, there was plenty of loud opposition to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris on the streets outside. At one stage, a small number of protesters even broke through police cordons and riot police had to be deployed. The Biden administration has stood by Israel, of course, since the mass murders of October the 7th. But as the civilian death toll has mounted in Gaza, this has become a neuralgic issue within the party, with the protesters claiming it could cost Harris the election, and she might deserve that fate.
It's loud, but it's relatively good-natured. It's certainly no 1968. The police are keeping their distance and simply marshalling the protesters, keeping them on the road. There's a helicopter above, but I don't think there is any serious violence. And the posters are suggesting huge support for the Palestinians and opposition to Israel. Also, some of them suggesting that American politicians bear responsibility, stop the genocide, they say. And one or two suggesting that Kamala Harris herself is involved and complicit. How much impact does any of this have within the convention centre and indeed in the wider nation? It doesn't look at the moment as if it is.
A few of the protesters made an attempt to get into the grounds of the convention centre, but they were easily repelled and no great violence ensued. Here inside, though, the issue is a hot one, and there are delegates and potential speakers who want it to be aired on the floor in front of the TV cameras. Tanya Haj Hassan is a paediatric intensive care doctor who's worked in Gaza.
I and every other doctor, surgeon, healthcare worker I know that's volunteered in Gaza in the last 10 months have a very urgent message for politicians, and it's essentially that we've been trained to protect and preserve human life, but this Israeli military campaign that's targeting life and everything needed to sustain it makes our job impossible.
You say you're here, and we are here, and we're in a corridor of the convention, but crucially, not on the convention floor. Have you been prevented from speaking? Are you hopeful still that you can? What's going on behind the scenes?
It's a good question. I actually don't know. I know there's been a lot of push from various people who understand the politics to try and provide space for healthcare workers who've been there and who've been bearing witness, because as you know, as an international journalist, you are not allowed to enter Gaza, so everything is happening in a black box, and we end up being the witness bearers to the genocide.
What's your view of the party and the way that it's handling this issue?
I think the party's behavior is really incomprehensible. I don't know how people sleep at night.
There's a moral case the protesters make, but there's also a practical one. They're threatening not to support a candidate who might need every single vote she can get. Hatem Abadaye was one of the organizers of the march on the convention center.
The only thing that she could possibly say that would get somebody like me to vote for her, if tomorrow she said, Israel, you must stop the genocide or we will stop sending you arms today.
Right, a complete arms embargo.
Complete.
She's not going to do that.
I don't think she'll do that, but she will see that there are people from all different religions and all age groups and all nationalities here in the thousands saying the same exact thing. And if they're not concerned about that, then, you know, they can go and lose the election. I don't really care.
You don't care? Seriously? Because that's what Kamala Harris says to you, isn't it? Seriously? You want Donald Trump?
Yeah, well, you know what? The lesser of two evils is an argument that people from the working class and people from the oppressed classes have been listening to for decades. They've been saying, do you want Donald Trump? Do you want George Bush? Do you want George Bush the Elder? But they haven't given us what they've promised. So at some point, people in this country are going to be like, you know what? I don't care about the lesser of two evils, because I am going to have to fight the Kamala Harris's of the world like I fight the Donald Trump's of the world.
Is she really no different?
Why would she be different?
Because she comes from the progressive left of the party.
I don't think so.
Obama didn't, Clinton certainly didn't, etc. So you could make the argument, couldn't you, that actually she is from a place that is much closer to you,
really,
and you ought to stick with her.
Kamala Harris is the left of the party? If anybody out of all the presidents in my lifetime who could be considered potentially progressive, it was Obama. Is she going to be better than Obama? He disavowed us all.
And she will too, you think?
Of course. She's already disavowed us. She doesn't have any relationships with people from our community. So if Clinton or Obama gave us nothing, why would Kamala give us anything?
Plainly, this is, to put it mildly, a distraction that Kamala Harris and her party could do without. Stephen Philp is a Chicago rabbi who describes himself as a progressive and wants the wider cause not to be sunk by Gaza.
I think an issue that we're increasingly seeing on the left here in the United States in particular is a sense of ethical purity. And what I mean by that is that there is a prevailing belief that to work in coalition with somebody, you have to be aligned on 100% of policy points. This is not how progress has been traditionally made in this country. It often means being in coalition with people that you don't agree with on every single thing. But unfortunately, you see an increasing sense of isolation between different groups that are misaligned on really minute issues, issues of importance, certainly, but issues that in the end, if we could come together and work around them, we'd be able to make the kind of incremental progress that is dissatisfying in the short term, but in the long term, so essential. When one is casting their vote for any politician, one has to think about, who is the person who is most likely to listen to my message? Who is the person where I can even move the needle slightly? And I think we have a clear answer in that being the Democratic Party in this situation.
Yeah, because what they say is they don't care. If Donald Trump is elected, they don't care. They feel so strongly about this single issue.
Well, the issue with single-issue voting is that we're not just voting on this one issue. We're voting on a wide range of issues. We're seeing a rollback in LGBTQ protections. We're seeing a rollback in abortion access. We're seeing a rollback in many different issues that are so vitally important to the coalition on the left. And so to allow any one of those things be the reason that we're not going to actually show up with the people who have been our partners on other issues in the past is going to be to our detriment.
And that was Rabbi Stephen Philp ending my report. I should say the New York Times reporting this morning that Gaza is going to be discussed on a panel, a sort of side meeting, which is officially sponsored now by the convention, but it is not at the moment planned to be discussed from the main stage.
22:08 is the time on Radio 4 this afternoon. A programme called A Year in the Life of the Swinging 60s is all about 1963, and what an arts show launched on the BBC that year tells us about the whole decade. The show was called The Public Ear, and delving into the archive revealed forgotten recordings, including this.
I'm Ringo and I play the drums.
I'm Paul and I play the bass.
I'm George and I play a guitar.
I'm John and I too play a guitar. Sometimes I play the fool.
And there was audience feedback too, and response.
Dear Public Ear, please could we be given warning at the beginning of a programme if there's going to be anything about the Beatles, as all Beatle fans can make sure to listen and have a chance to ring up other fans. Yours Beatle Madly, Barbara Garnett, Grimshaw Lane, Ormskirk.
Thanks for the letter, Barbara, and we're on today later on, so don't forget, get on the phone and get all your friends listening.
I think that's Ringo Starr again right there. And the Public Ear's premise was to capture essentially what's happening, what was happening in the UK art scene. And there was plenty of it at the time in a decade that we remember as the swinging 60s. James Peake is here in the studio with me, the writer and presenter of the programme that's on Radio 4 later today. Morning, James. So what made you focus then on 1963?
Well, the fact that the Public Ear spanned this incredibly seismic time in British culture, the blast radius of which is still with us today. It just so happens that from autumn 1963 to spring 1964, so much was happening. The National Theatre and Kenneth Tyner's National Theatre, Mary Quant and fashion, and then of course Beatlemania just starting up. When this show started, Please Please Me was just being recorded in Abbey Road in a single day. By the time the show's run came to an end, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of fans desperate for Beatles news. And this show really caught that that moment in time.
But it didn't last long, did it?
No, it only lasted 13 shows, and that's a tragedy. But the silver lining is that we found them all again. We have every single one of them now. And it's this priceless sort of historical document, if you like, of this time that we hold so dear.
Because of who appeared on it, because people like the Beatles were on it, and essentially we'd forgotten those early recordings of them speaking.
Yes, we sort of knew that they existed, and the archives have got a wonderful paper trail, and, you know, the Radio Circle found these things, tracked them down, and this whole programme has been a tremendously brilliant and effective joint effort between the Radio Circle and BBC Archives. And so we can now sort of reveal this tremendous archive that hasn't been heard for 60 years.
And did you re-reveal some of this to Joan Bakewell, who's in your programme?
Yeah, that was an absolute joy. So I was a bit dastardly, and Joan said that, yes, she'd love to hear this archive. And I said, fine, but I'm not going to let you hear any of it until we're recording you. So she was cast back into 1963 when her own career was taking off, although she wasn't involved in the public ear. Of course, she was, very much there for the 60s. And so hearing this archive of Mary Quant and Morecambe and Wise, and then, of course, the Beatles, she found very nostalgic and very affecting.
Why didn't it last, the programme? It was on the Light programme, which was...
Yeah, that's right.
We should probably explain it as the precursor to Radio 1 and Radio 2.
Yes.
Would be the best way to think of it.
That's right. Before 1, 2, 3, 4 all sort of split up and did their own groovy things, the Light programme was a real sort of, bellwether for culture. And this was a really progressive and exciting show with young and hip sort of presenters and reporters, and also weirdly Danny Blanchflower, who was the Tottenham manager at Tottenham Hotspur manager at the time. And you've got him talking about, oh, you know, British attitudes to international football are rubbish and we really need to raise our game. This is, of course, in 1963, just 3 years later, our only victory in the World Cup. So somebody was listening. And it was a really progressive show, really forward-looking. I just hope people will go to archives and listen to this show, which is now available.
And it sounds as if great talent spotting or spotting of the zeitgeist and people who absolutely then endured, not just the Beatles, but others who formed part of that that cultural mix of the swinging 60s in London.
Yes. I mean, for instance, fashion. So Mary Quant does this wonderful thing, Are You a Square Dresser?, where she's saying, you know, gentlemen, are you still wearing those cravats with little sausage dogs on them? Get with it. Come on. and then we have Kenneth Tynan defending the idea of the National Theatre, which is just setting up. He sort of merrily says, oh, yes, it's going to lose £150,000 a year, but it's going to democratise theatre. And it did, and it has. So all of these wonderful things that sort of had their genesis in 1963 and 1964 still resonate today.
James Peake, thank you. And the programme A Year in the Life of the Swinging 60s is on our Radio 4 at 4 o'clock today and on BBC Sounds.
14 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Dr. Rachel Mann, who is the Archdeacon of Salford and Bolton. Good morning.
Good morning. May God have mercy on our souls. The headline says it all as outlets around the world reported the sighting of a doomsday fish. This strange, elongated and rarely seen fish can grow up to 36 feet, and its appearance has, for many cultures across the centuries, presaged natural disaster. Kayakers found the dead 12-foot-long fish in Californian waters last week. As reporters gleefully noted, Los Angeles was struck by a 4.4 magnitude earthquake 2 days later. The headline writers would have struggled to grab our attention if they'd had to use its real name, the oarfish. Of course, no one really thinks it was either an omen or a cause of the earthquake. It's surely a classic example of the post hoc fallacy. Just because something happens after an event doesn't mean it was caused by it. The story of the doomsday fish is simply superstition. Like many religious people, I've been told by well-meaning folk that my faith is pure superstition, that I cling on to Bronze Age beliefs in a sky fairy who has no valuable place in a modern scientifically informed society. I get this. At the same time, few of us are as rational as we think. Indeed, psychologists have identified something called superstitious learning as a common behaviour. This is where we instinctively connect events and try to find causation. It can lead us to look at the daily habits of another person, a Bill Gates, say, and think that by copying them, we will become successful ourselves. The Bible is resistant to superstitious practices. In Deuteronomy, the Israelites are warned against soothsaying or interpreting omens because such behaviour gets in the way of trusting God. Throughout Scripture, God's prophets are less focused on predicting the future than calling people back to God's ways of justice, mercy and peace. Their work is discerning wise action, guided by the principles of God's law. Yet the resilience of superstitious practices in the modern age, whether that relates to anxieties about doomsday fish or magical thinking about what might bring success, is striking. The 16th century Anglican theologian Richard Hooker suggests that the good life rests on three pillars: scripture, tradition, and reason. He says that by combining the wisdom embedded in the Bible or history with the best of modern thinking, we live better lives. His insight assures me that being a human is never simply about being purely rational. By embracing the rich varieties of learning, scientific, instinctive, spiritual, we can foster a broader understanding of being human. And yes, that includes celebrating the rare and unusual, like the doomsday fish.
And that was Thought for the Day with Dr. Rachel Mann. It brings us to 11 minutes to 8.
The latest drug death figures for Scotland will be published today, always closely watched because of how high they've been for years. Scotland has had not only the worst drug death rate in the UK, but in Europe. The drugs in question are largely opiates and opioids, such as heroin, morphine and methadone. And last year, there was a significant drop in the number of deaths. It's an issue we followed on this programme. And in Glasgow, one measure to try and tackle it is a planned consumption room, which would be a legal space for people to take drugs. I went last year to see the site where it would be, where there is an existing NHS prescription service for people addicted to heroin, and heard from one of the doctors involved.
We prescribe the injectable opiate treatment, but in a safer drug consumption facility, that is very much predicated on people bringing their own drugs into the environment. But hopefully, through that engagement, coming into formal treatment and care as
but
well.
At the beginning, wouldn't it make you more nervous to think you've no idea what the quality is of what people are injecting? They might well have an overdose right in front of you.
So that's what happens every day. So from our perspective, it's much more preferable that if that's going to happen, that happens in the vicinity of trained staff who can respond.
Well, James Cook, our Scotland editor, is at the same place now, that site where it's still at planning stage, isn't it, James, that this consumption room hasn't yet opened?
Yes, Michelle. It's actually a bit closer than that. There's work going on right now. I can see some vans have just arrived and there's fencing up and construction work going on. They had hoped it might be open by this summer, but I've just heard this morning a date suggested of the 21st of October, and they do seem pretty hopeful that it can open then.
What's the expectation for today's figures? Clearly the hope would be that there's another drop, but is that realistic?
Unfortunately, I don't think it is, Michelle. I mean, we won't know for sure until the figures are out, but we do get interim figures, slightly different figures from the police, and the indications there are not good. They suggest that there might be a rise, perhaps of around 10%. We'll have to wait to see the figures themselves. And although there was a dip, as you rightly point out, last year of perhaps a fifth in the number of deaths, there were still 1,051 drug deaths in Scotland, which is obviously not a big country. The worst level, as you point out, in the UK and the whole of Europe. And there's particular concern about women. Most of the fall that we saw last year was among men. And in 2022, men were twice as likely to die as women from drug misuse. But in the early 2000s, men were four or five times more likely to die. So there's been a narrowing between the sexes.
Well, what is the cause of, this drug consumption room, which I've seen and where you are now, this would only be one measure to try and tackle it. But what do we know about why it hasn't opened yet?
I think simply these things take time, Michelle. I don't think there's any great conspiracy. I think it's not running horrendously late. I think it's just a case that they're going through planning, they're going through consultation with the local community, and I think that process has been quite thorny. I think there's been a degree of opposition, to say the least, among the local community, and I think they're trying to win people over as well. But I mean, looking at it here, I think simply speaking, the work is still going on. I think in the wider sense, the question about where we're going with these drug deaths figures will be interesting, because it isn't just that we'll get the figures. We'll hear about trends, Michelle, as well, in terms of usage. And there's some suggestion that drug death usage is changing. One of the key problems in Scotland has been what's called polydrug use, very simply more than one drug being taken together. And there's suggestions that what they're seeing now, appearing cut with, adulterated with some drugs, are more powerful synthetic opioids such as nitazenes, also an animal tranquilizer called xylazine, and that also we're hearing from some drugs workers, they're seeing a trend away from the injection of opioids to more smoking of crack cocaine. Now this site is particularly designed, or is more likely to deal with, the injection of opioids, so there's some concern about how they will handle smoking and whether that's something that will need an additional policy response.
James Cook, thank you. And also with us is Austin Smith, who's the head of policy practice and communications at the Scottish Drugs Forum, which is a charity focused on improving the approach to drug-related issues. Morning, Austin. What would you say would be the main ways to change this sobering picture in Scotland that haven't yet been used?
Good morning, Michelle. Yes. Well, we have to follow the evidence, and the evidence is there's things we can stop people having an overdose from that becoming a fatal overdose. So that's the naloxone program, where we've been getting naloxone out into communities and amongst people who are at risk, so who get their own provision, and the family can get provision and so on.
It's an emergency drug, I should explain, for anyone who doesn't know. It's essentially, hopefully stops you dying of what could have been a fatal overdose.
Yeah, so it's that, for that immediate response to the adverse effects of an opioid, like heroin. And then there's other things we can do which are kind of longer term and preventative around getting people into treatment. So the World Health Organization's recommended treatment is substitution treatment, which means prescribing another drug, most likely methadone. And then there's bigger things we can do, or wider things we can do, around anti-poverty measures, housing measures, and employment measures, which are where the root causes of the problem lie in that kind of inequalities and poverty.
Can we focus on the getting people into treatment side?
Sure.
Where that isn't happening, is it because people are resisting or can't be reached, or because the system, the health service, the Scottish government, it is just failing to do the right things to reach them or convince them?
Yeah, well, the failure has been is now measurable, if you like. We have what they call medication-assisted treatment standards. So these standards were introduced in 2021 and were meant to be fully implemented by April this year. And frankly, they're not. And they're nowhere near being fully implemented in any area across Scotland. But these standards were to make services, first of all, accessible, to allow people to get into treatment the day they present, and to be acceptable. That's the term my organisation would use, acceptable to people. In other words, the treatment, the regime of the treatment, was something that people found beneficial to them for their short-term goals, what they wanted immediately, but also for the medium and longer-term goals. And we're failing to do that because we're failing to build therapeutic relationships with people. The important thing about treatment is we can get into the details of prescribing and dosing and all the rest of it, but it's that people have choice and are empowered to make those choices. So if we think of addiction or dependency as a process of disempowerment, we should be empowering people to take more control over their own lives.
Does that mean that you favour a greater use of NHS prescription service, such as what is already available on that site in Glasgow, that essentially you are prescribing and allowing people to take, you know, drugs that are very dangerous, but in a safer setting and in a supervised setting?
So let's not get confused. But people do become confused about this because the Glasgow model. So the prescribing services can prescribe methadone or a preparation of buprenorphine or diamorphine, which is something more closer to a pharmaceutical heroin. And those can be provided for the person to take home or to take under supervision. The service is opening in Glasgow, the Safer Consumption Room. People are bringing in their own street drugs and using those in front of staff who will be able to intervene if there's a problem and offer to advise. So those are two different services. But in terms of the treatment, yes, that's we should be getting more people into treatment. So one of the things that's significantly different about Scotland is, one, we have far more people who have got a drug problem, but we also have far fewer of those, a proportion of those people in treatment compared with England and Wales or compared with other places in Europe.
Okay. Austin Smith from the Scottish Drugs Forum, thank you.
A couple of minutes to eight, Thomas Schaffernacker with the weather.
Yes, and it's going to be a very blustery day today across the northern half of the UK, with frequent showers sweeping in off the Atlantic. And actually, some of them have already been very heavy, particularly across Lancashire. Plenty of them across the Pennines at the moment. Winds will be strongest around coast, as you might imagine. 40 to 50 mile an hour winds, so really windy for the time of the year. There will be some sunshine around for sure. I think the best of the sunny spells in the north will be to the east of the Pennines, as well as the far north of Scotland, say the Northern Isles. But temperatures here in Glasgow and Belfast around 15, 16 Celsius. To the south, across the rest of England and Wales, it will be a much brighter day with some showers around, particularly the further west you are. The best of the sun will be along the south coast of England, around the southeast and east Anglia. And here temperatures actually peaking maybe in London up to about 24 degrees. Quiet night on the way, and then tomorrow wet and windy in the northwest of the UK.
Thomas, thank you.
Escape with a good book on BBC Sounds, like Yellowface by Rebecca F. Kwong.
I play up our connection. My grief over her death becomes a cornerstone of my origin story.
Enlightenment by Sarah Perry.
Thomas examined the image of a stone woman stuck on the verges of the lake. I suppose she's in the water now. What is she holding?
And Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin.
Do you have a mistress? I asked him. I don't seem to be very interested in women right now.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Coming up in the next hour on this programme, we will be paying tribute to Taylor Swift as her European tour ends tonight. The last show in London, we'll be looking back on what she brought to the summer of 2024.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 this morning from London and Chicago. It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 20th of August. The headlines this morning. The outgoing US President Joe Biden has endorsed Kamala Harris as his successor during a forceful defence of his record at the Democratic Party convention. The authorities in Sicily say a senior banker is among six people still missing after a yacht capsized off the coast more than 24 hours ago. And a rocket engine has exploded during testing at the UK's new spaceport in Shetland. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
An emotional Joe Biden has told Democratic supporters that they're in a battle for the very soul of America. The outgoing president was addressing the party's national convention in Chicago in a speech at times drowned out by chants of "Thank you, Joe." The four-day event will confirm his vice president, Kamala Harris, as the Democratic presidential candidate to take on Donald Trump. From Chicago, our North America editor Sarah Smith has this report.
Biden was cheered to the rafters as he arrived on stage by a party that was, in effect, saying goodbye to him. During more than 4.5 minutes of sustained applause, some of his supporters had tears in their eyes, and it looked like he did too. Running through his achievements in office, he was able to list record job creation, massive spending on infrastructure, a gun safety law, and he proclaimed that despite the Russian invasion, Ukraine is still free. He also said he wasn't finished yet.
I've got 5 months left in my presidency. I've got a lot to do. I intend to get it done. You see, it's been the honor of my lifetime to serve as your president. I love the job, but I love my country more.
It must have been very bittersweet to have his party celebrating him so loudly because he agreed to step aside, congratulating him on his achievements because he's handing over to a younger candidate. President Biden knows the best way to cement his legacy and what he managed to get done as president is to get Kamala Harris elected as his successor. And he said he would be the best volunteer the Harris campaign could ever have.
The search for six people missing after a luxury yacht sank off the coast of Sicily is resuming this morning. Among them are the British technology tycoon Mike Lynch and his daughter. The 180-foot yacht went down in a storm yesterday. 15 people were rescued, including Mr. Lynch's wife, Angela Bacares, and a one-year-old British girl. A man's body has been recovered. From Sicily, our correspondent Mark Lowen reports.
More names are emerging of those engulfed by the sea as their superyacht, the Baesian, capsized here in Porticello. As well as the tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch and his 18-year-old daughter Hannah, Sicily's civil protection says Jonathan Bloomer, the chairman of the investment bank Morgan Stanley International, and Chris Morvillo, a lawyer for Mr. Lynch, are among the six passengers still missing. We watched as diver rescue teams returned to shore late last night, with the operation set to resume this morning. It's thought likely that bodies will be found trapped on the seabed in the wreckage of the Baesian, which was hit by a waterspout, a tornado-like column of cloud and water that snapped the mast, with the yacht quickly swallowed up by the waves.
2 months ago, Mike Lynch was acquitted in the US of fraud charges related to the sale of the software company Autonomy. It's emerged that his co-defendant, Stephen Chamberlain, has died after being hit by a car in Cambridgeshire on Saturday. A lawyer for Mr. Chamberlain, who was also cleared, said he'd been fatally injured while out running. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is travelling to Egypt as he continues his push for a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza. After talks in Jerusalem yesterday, Mr. Blinken said Israel had accepted what he called a bridging proposal and urged Hamas to do the same. More from our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison.
Antony Blinken says he got what he came for in Israel. He says Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accepts and supports the so-called bridging proposal towards a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza. The US Secretary of State now heads to Egypt and Qatar to try to get them to put pressure on Hamas to do the same. But the Islamist group has called US talk of progress an illusion, and at least publicly, there is little sign that either Hamas or Israel is committed to a deal. Mr. Blinken said it was crucial that everyone refrain from actions that would escalate tensions. Overnight, Israel's military says it targeted a Hezbollah weapons store in Lebanon, and Hamas says a number of its senior figures were killed in Israeli airstrikes in Gaza yesterday. It also claimed to have been involved in a bomb attack in Tel Aviv on Sunday.
A community in southern Israel has announced the death of a hostage in Gaza. The statement from kibbutz near Oz says Avraham Munda, who was 79, was the victim of months of physical and mental torture. His wife, daughter and grandson, who were also taken hostage, were released as part of a truce last November. Ukraine says its air defences have shot down 3 Russian missiles and 25 drones aimed at several regions overnight. There have also been dozens of Russian attacks around 2 towns it's trying to seize in eastern Ukraine. Moscow's slow advances have continued in spite of Ukraine's incursion into Russia's southern region of Kursk. Our correspondent James Waterhouse reports from Kyiv.
The optimistic take of one member of Ukraine's defence committee was that the country's cross-border offensive into Russia was not yet fully playing its role and that the situation on the eastern front lines could yet change. The goal, or hope for Kyiv, is that by taking Russian territory, invading forces would be drawn from elsewhere. President Zelensky claims his troops now control almost 500 square miles, but the situation on his own land is only worsening. There are continued heavy clashes around the eastern cities of Pokrovsk and Turetsk, and Russian forces are still slowly advancing in multiple areas, tightening their grip of the eastern Donetsk region. It's an illustration of the gamble Kyiv took by deploying thousands of its best troops hundreds of miles to the north to instead cross the border into Russia.
A rocket engine has exploded during a test at Britain's new spaceport in Shetland. The test was carried out by a German company, RFA, who hope eventually to send the UK's first vertical rocket into orbit. 3 months ago, its first test at the Saxavord spaceport on the island of Unst was declared a success. Our Scotland correspondent, Lorna Gordon, was watching in Shetland. The full nine-engine ground-based test was part of a number of trials due to be carried out before RFA progressed to launching its rockets into space. A small crowd had gathered across a bay from the spaceport to watch. Large flames and plumes of smoke could initially be seen shooting horizontally from the side of the rocket, and there were loud bangs as the entire structure was then engulfed by fire. In a statement, Saxaford Spaceport said all safety protocols were fully observed and the site was evacuated prior to the test, leaving no staff at risk. RFA said the data they had gathered would be analysed and their goal would be to return to regular operations as soon as possible.
Campaigners have warned that thousands of miles of footpaths could be lost because of delays by councils in dealing with applications. The government has set a deadline of 2031 for all rights of way in England and Wales to be added to an official map, but thousands of requests have not been processed. Emily Unier reports.
All historic rights of way must be officially recorded by 2031, according to rules set out in the Countryside and Rights of Way Act 2000. But new research by the BBC has found that as of March this year, nearly 8,000 requests for paths to be added to the map were still waiting to be determined by councils in England and Wales, with almost a dozen dating back to the 1980s. Campaigners are concerned that the backlog could mean some paths are lost forever. A spokesperson for DEFRA said new rights of way reforms would help to process applications faster, but dealing with them was the responsibility of local authorities. The Local Government Association said competing pressures continued to affect the ability of councils to address the backlog and deal with applications as quickly as they'd like.
Swarms of robot aircraft are being developed in the UK to tackle wildfires by spotting flames and working together to put them out. Final testing is taking place on the self-flying drones, as Harriet Bradshaw reports.
Swarm engineering is a way of making many robots work together on a specific task. A team of firefighters, engineers and scientists from the UK have been testing this approach to see whether it could be used to tackle wildfires. During trials at an airfield in Cornwall, three drones worked together autonomously to spot a real fire, alert the other drones to it before mimicking dropping down as if to put it out with water. The swarm can adapt to changes in a similar way to how a flock of birds can fly in a coordinated manner. The benefits include making it easier to monitor large areas, as well as detect and respond to fires more quickly. In the future, the team says this technique could see 20 to 30 autonomous planes, each with a wingspan of around 30 feet, patrolling large and remote areas in different parts of the world.
The first £1 coins featuring the king come into circulation this week. Nearly 3 million of the new designs will be making their way into people's pockets and tills across the UK via post offices and banks.
Thank you. 8:10 is the time. Here in Chicago, Joe Biden has quit the scene. His speech was delivered late after prime time on TV, and it was angrier than Kamala Harris tends to be when talking about Donald Trump. But there was huge affection for the president from those watching here in the convention center, and they got to see him acknowledge that he was not part of the nation's future.
Like many of you, I've given my heart and soul to our nation. And I've been blessed a million times in return with the support of the American people. I've either been too young to be in the Senate because I wasn't 30 yet, and too old to stay as president. But I hope you know how grateful I am to all of you.
He is, of course, still president, but his involvement in the presidential election is now as a sideshow. Last night, he seemed to be trying his very hardest to convince his party, the nation, perhaps himself, that Kamala Harris was the woman to beat Donald Trump.
But she'll be a president our children can look up to. She'll be a president respected by world leaders because she already is. She'll be a president we can all be proud of. And she will be a historic president who puts her stamp on America's future.
We can hear now from one of the very small team who were with Joe Biden in the last days of his candidacy. So after the debate disaster, as he tried to stay on and many in his party tried to push him out, Anita Dunn was his senior advisor and friend. She left the White House a few days after Biden announced that he was no longer going to be the candidate. I asked her whether she thought that if he had stayed, he could have won.
I do believe he could have won. I believe he believes he could have won. But he also believes that he made the right decision by getting out of the race, uniting the party behind Vice President Harris. And he is now prepared to do whatever he needs to do to really add volunteer-in-chief to his list of jobs to get her elected, because it is so critical to defeat Donald Trump.
When you say he believes that he could have won, do you think he still believes that he could have won?
I'm sure he doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about it. But, you know, it was a winnable race. It was a tough race. It was a very close race.
Winnable, though, even after the debate performance?
Yes, absolutely.
How come? How would that have worked?
You know, voters had a very different reaction to that than a lot of our elites and our press did. They already knew Joe Biden was old. What they hadn't seen for a long time was Donald Trump unfiltered. They don't watch his 90-minute rallies. They don't listen to his kind of right-wing interviews. And seeing him, hearing him, reminded voters of why they had voted against him to begin with and why they didn't think he should be returned to president. So the structural nature of the race didn't change very much from the debate. What did change was that the party divided on the question of whether or not Biden should continue to be the nominee for president. And ultimately, the president made the decision that he should step aside in the interest of beating Donald Trump.
He made that decision. But he was pushed, was he?
But he made the decision. You know, you can't really push an incumbent president out of the job unless the president makes the decision to step aside. And he made that decision. And it was his decision that we needed a united party, and that we needed a united party that he was not going to be able to bring about, at least in the near term. So his decision, which I believe he will always say was the right decision, because at the end of the day, he thinks that electing Kamala Harris and defeating Donald Trump is more important. So, you respect his decision. Even as he made it, he did not believe that he would lose the race.
Behind the scenes, what does he think of Kamala Harris? Because there is a legitimate question, isn't there, that if she is the wonderful candidate that everyone is now saying that she is, why on earth wasn't she the candidate? Why on earth hadn't he already taken the decision to go?
Well, the reason he hadn't taken the decision to step aside is because he has a lot he wanted to get done, and he felt he was the best candidate for 2024, but he didn't feel he was the only person who could defeat Donald Trump. You know, how does he feel about her? He picked her to be vice president in 2020. He picked Kamala Harris because he believed that she was the best qualified. And one of the interesting things here is that you don't see anyone questioning whether or not she is qualified to be president of the United States. And that is what being vice president for 3.5 years gets you.
Really crucially, at the end of that period, when people were plotting against him and suggesting to him, either publicly or privately, that he had to go, it's really interesting, isn't it, that she was not part of that. And that feels quite important.
You know, she has been loyal to him. She also kept her staff from even the slightest whisper, and that speaks well, not just for her, but also for the loyalty her staff have to her and to President Biden. I think that she conducted herself admirably during this period, but he trusted her, and she trusts him, and she does see him as a transformational president. I think that you've heard it in her speeches. What you've heard from the president is that he believes she's the person who can go out and beat Donald Trump and move this country forward. So
she's under a lot of pressure now, and she's going to be under pressure, particularly after the convention is finished, to start to do difficult interviews, to do things that don't involve autocue and staged events. Should she, or is there a kind of glide path, do you think, to the presidency for her that actually involves just the big change of mood that there has been and using that?
That's a great question. I think it is probably a mixture, and she's been vice president for 3.5 years. She's fully capable of going out and doing an interview, and I fully expect her to do so. She's done a lot as vice president. You know, one of the things I've found amusing over the last 29 days since the switch has been that some people are surprised at how well she connects with audiences and how effective she is at these events. And I say, you haven't been watching her, because she's been out there doing this now for a couple of years and getting a great response and really was prepared to step into this role. So I think what you'll see is a mixture, and you'll see her laying out more policy proposals. It's a campaign. She has to go make her case to the American people.
Mm. Can I ask you about Donald Trump and his response to Kamala Harris? Because you are someone who has absolutely advised at the very highest level American politicians, and of course most recently the president himself. What do you make at the moment of the Trump camp? And I suppose the crucial question, can you see them coming back from the malaise that they're in at the moment?
Well, you know, it's still an extraordinarily close race. And people forget that in 2016, he also went through an exceptionally rocky summer and then pulled himself together to some extent in September and October. He's not the same person he was in 2016, 8 years older. And it's not clear that he can exercise that kind of control of message that is really required for him to regain the offensive in this race. He's going to come out of this convention behind in the polls, because I think that she'll get a decent bump out of this convention. And as people get to know her. They like what she's saying, and they like this idea that we can move past and move forward again, that we can have change in this country. And that's a hard thing for him to argue against. And so the real question is whether he can exercise the self-discipline to stick to a coherent message between now and November. And I can't answer that.
Anita Dunn, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me.
And the time is now 18 minutes past seven. Let's bring you back to events here and some big questions. Does prison work? Or do we need to rethink the use of custody? Those who work in the justice system, especially prison governors, often think the latter, because the wider picture, even before the jailing of people in large numbers over the riots, was so precarious. There was one prison with just a single spare bed, HMP Durham, others with a handful. It's not where you want the system to be if you want it to function swiftly enough for people to feel justice is not being denied. Today, more people charged with crimes are being held in police cells rather than transferred to the magistrates' courts and possibly remanded in custody. As we heard earlier, the court summons can't happen unless there is a prison place available. Before we hear from a minister, let's turn to Phil Jones, who's the custody lead for the Police Federation of England and Wales. Phil, what are the issues with the emergency measures in place now?
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I think first and foremost, this isn't an immediate thing. This has been a problem within the criminal justice system for many years, which has been widely broadcast through the Prison Governors, Prisoner Officers Association, around the challenges of capacity and demand. We know that police stations are not prisons. They're not suitable to be used for any great length of time. The idea around a custody provision is that it assists the officers to do an investigation, and we have up to 24 hours to be able to hold somebody to do the inquiries. You know, although police officers are highly skilled and trained, they're not prison officers, and prison officers have really specific training around detainee welfare and the needs of prisoners. So the police estate, the police custodies aren't geared to be prisons.
So what's your worry then, that things will just get out of hand, prisoners will suffer, police officers will feel they can't cope?
I mean, first and foremost, I think it's just, you know, we need to reassure you that our dedicated members will do their utmost to look after detainees. They will continue business as usual to try and bring offenders to justice. But I think the warning signs for me, if I may use an example of the NHS, we've seen every week the pressures of A&E departments with bed blocking. And if prisoners are held in custodies for a sustained period of time, accepting that the Up Early Dawn has suggested that it's going to be happening for 2 or 3 weeks, but if we have a sustained period of time where prisoners are in police cells, then there could be a situation in moving forward where we don't have the capacity in the system to do business as usual.
Can you describe the difference between a police cell and the facilities or the measures around that and a prison cell?
I can only perhaps talk about police cells. I've not seen inside of a prison cell other than through the media, but a police cell will have often a concrete bed, lower to the floor, a toilet and washing facilities. They are very, very basic, which don't obviously cater for long-term occupation. prison cells may have radios, may have TVs, and may have, you know, an individual could have their kind of creature comforts in terms of pillows and other things. Police cells won't allow that to happen.
So if I, the idea of someone being in a police cell for a week or 2 to 3 weeks, if that's how long this policy is in place, what alarm bells ring to you when you think of that?
I very much doubt that somebody would be in police cells for that period of time, given the reassurances from the National Police Chiefs Council and the partnership work that's taking place. So every morning there will be regular meetings to identify individuals who may be in the system that need obviously taken to courts, and those conversations will be had, risk assessments will be undertaken. So hopefully that eventuality will never take place.
But if, I mean, a week is not impossible, is it? If you can't, at the moment, under the rules, you can't get a magistrate's court summons unless there's a prison cell or space or bed available. And we know how full they are at the moment. And it's going to take a while for the measures announced after Labour came to power to come into effect.
And again, those pressures have been recognised by government, and the government have made a commitment to build new prisons, do investment, but there needs to be wider investments across the criminal justice system, not just with prisons, but in the court system, with policing. You know, historically, we've seen a significant underfunding across the criminal justice system. So improvements do absolutely need to be made. I'm reassured by the representations from the National Police Chiefs Council and the escalation processes that they have in place, that people wouldn't be kept in custody for that period of time.
Phil Jones from the Police Federation, thank you very much. And Joe Stevens, the Secretary of State for Wales, joins us because the Prime Minister is visiting Wales today. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
First of all, what is the maximum length of time that you think Operation Early Dawn will be in place?
Well, we expect it to be a short-term measure. It's a long-standing contingency measure that's used for very short periods, you know, for a matter of days or at the most months to tackle immediate pressures. And, you know, we have inherited a justice system in crisis. We've had to take very difficult decisions, but very necessary decisions in order to keep it operating. You know, the male prison estate in England and Wales has been operating at unsafe levels for years, 99% full, so very little capacity in the system. And the Prime Minister has been clear that this is completely unacceptable. So we've had to have the prison service activate this emergency measure in order to deal with it.
But there are still questions that arise from it, aren't there? And we've been hearing them throughout the programme this morning. What's the maximum length of time you envisage someone being held in a police cell rather than be taken to a magistrate's court?
So we would anticipate that this should be no longer than a day after being charged. That's the basis on which we are working. So anyone who poses a risk to the public will obviously not be bailed. They'll be held in a police station until they're summoned to court, and that should be no later than the day after being charged.
But that's not an assurance, is it? That's an anticipation. And the worry that we heard from solicitors is that because you have this system where you can't even go to the magistrate's court if there isn't a prison space, just in case you get remanded in custody, that process gets delayed. And often, 50% of the time, she said, someone who's been refused police bail does get it through the magistrate's court.
Well, as I say, anyone who poses a risk to the public won't be bailed. And we are working on the basis that there should be, you know, no longer than a day after being charged, people will transfer into a prison cell rather than being held in a police cell. But as I say, we're having to make really difficult decisions here. We have inherited a crisis, an emergency situation, and that's why we've had to initiate Operation Early Dawn in order to make sure that people who pose a risk to the public are kept in custody and are not out on the streets.
Yeah, but the prison population doesn't change instantly, does it? The same position that was the case before the riots in England is still there. Indeed, it's a bit worse because of people who have already been jailed. And that's why there are these fears about the knock-on effect through the system. I wonder just what your broad approach to this is going to be as a government. Is it in line with what the prisons minister is known to believe from his role as the former chair of the Prison Reform Trust, that there are as many as a third of prisoners who shouldn't be behind bars?
Well, clearly what we want to stop is a cycle of reoffending. So at the moment we have a situation where for many, many years, people who are given a custodial sentence go to prison. And there are two purposes to a prison sentence. One is obviously punishment because you lose your livelihood and your liberty. But the second purpose of prison is rehabilitation. And what we know, because of that cycle of reoffending and the reoffending rates rising, is that people are not getting the rehabilitation services that they need within prison. So they go out of prison, they reoffend, and they go straight back in. We have to break that cycle. Now, that is part of a long-term plan for criminal justice. We want to make sure that, you know, people only go to prison if they should be in prison. We want to make sure that as many of them who can be rehabilitated are rehabilitated, so that when they come out of prison, they don't reoffend and they can start to turn their lives around and make a contribution again.
So just so I understand, the longer term plan is fewer people being sent to prison in the first place?
Well, we want to prevent crime. You know, that's why we're going to have 13,000 extra neighbourhood officers on the streets. We want to tackle antisocial behaviour. But there are, you know, people who are convicted of serious crime who have to go to prison because they've convicted an offence where the sentencing guideline is a custodial sentence. But once they're in prison, we need to rehabilitate people so they don't reoffend again.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's an answer to my question. Is the longer term plan fewer people overall being sent to prison? Because only that would significantly change our numbers.
But if you break the cycle of reoffending, fewer people will be going into prison.
Jo Stevens, Secretary of State for Wales, thank you.
28 minutes past eight to the sport. Here's Cathy.
Morning. Thank you very much. The last game of the opening round of Premier League fixtures ended in a 1-1 draw between Leicester City and Tottenham. Jamie Vardy scored the equaliser for Leicester after Pedro Porro's first half goal for Spurs. Well, 10 days left of the summer transfer window, Chelsea have agreed a fee in principle for the Atletico Madrid forward João Félix. Conor Gallagher goes in the other direction as part of that deal, while Brighton have completed the signing of the 22-year-old French forward Jorginho Rutter for a club record fee of £40 million from Leeds. Football clubs are changing, though, how they use statistics and analyse performances when it comes to signing new players. Ian Graham was the director of research at Liverpool for over a decade, from 2012 until last year, and is the author of How to Win the Premier League. It's a bold claim, Ian. Are you taking credit for Liverpool's first Premier League title in 30 years and perhaps a Champions League win?
I'll take a small amount of credit. The players and the management really need to take most of it, though.
What data did you use during that time to make sure that you were involved in those pivotal decisions at a club like Liverpool and that you were listened to?
It's the players that really make the difference between a winning team and a losing team. And so the data we used focused on the performance of the players and also the financial aspects of paying for players. The performance data is optically collected by cameras at stadiums, 25 frames per second. We see the players' positions and the position of the ball, and we try and distill that into a view, an estimate of the players' performance and how they might improve our team's chance of winning.
Was it unusual to be using that, as in were many other clubs using it as well at the same time?
Yeah, Liverpool were the first Premier League team to have a data department in-house. Prior to Liverpool, I worked for Tottenham Hotspur for 5 years as a consultant. Apart from Liverpool, Arsenal and Manchester City, the three big clubs that used data, Brighton and Brentford also achieved promotion to the Premier League and success in the Premier League using data, and that was due to the direction their owners insisted on. Their owners had both made their fortunes through sports betting.
Yeah, Brighton are a really interesting case. I just mentioned they've signed a player, Rutter, on club record fee. Compared to some other clubs who've been struggling with the Premier League's financial rules, Brighton last season announced the biggest annual profit in the league of over £122 million post-tax at a time when they also qualified for Europe for the first time in their history, reached the FA Cup semi-finals, they were sixth in the Premier League, but they also have a much lower wage bill than others. Is that the kind of direction that clubs are looking at, and how much of a difference do you think data has made for them to be able to be in that position?
Yeah, Brighton have been really impressive. Their owner has invested heavily into the club, but the amount of performance that they achieve per pound spent far exceeds most of the clubs in the Premier League. Data, as I believe, quite a central part of the way Brighton scout for players, understand their own performances as well. The money they invest through data analysis, through scouting, to sign players, and they spend, as you've seen with the Rutter signing, they're happy to spend money on players, but those players consistently produce performances. And in the last two or three years, Brighton have seen the upside of signing good young players, which is the ability to sell them on for massive profits and then reinvest those profits into improving the squad further.
And what do you think are the advantages over conventional scouting?
If you can only watch one game, I would prefer to watch the game live rather than collect data on the game, because data doesn't see everything about the game. But what data does is it allows you to see every game in a consistent and objective manner. There's so much football going on, and there's such a wide market of players. You know, Brighton have signed from Ecuador, from Argentina, from many European countries. It's impossible for scouting or for someone watching games on video to have the breadth of knowledge of the entire football market. So data allows you to benchmark players playing in Ecuador versus players playing in Austria.
Yeah, as a data nerd, I find that fascinating. Thank you very much, Ian Graham, the author of How to Win the Premier League. Just a quick cricket line, and Matthew Potts has been called up to the England side for the first test against Sri Lanka, which starts tomorrow at Emirates Old Trafford.
Kathy, thank you very much. Let's look ahead to Jamal Khalili.
Good morning. It's a new series of The Life Scientific, and we're kicking off with a computer pioneer who also happens to be one of the world's richest men, a global philanthropist, a subject of conspiracy theories, and in fact, a college dropout. I am talking, of course, about Mr. Bill Gates. After years building his Microsoft empire and a vast fortune to boot, his priority now is giving that money away. And his philanthropic ethos is very much guided by science. I'll be talking to Bill about the Gates Foundation's work tackling health issues in some of the world's poorest countries and finding out what TV he's been binge-watching. That's The Life Scientific after the news at 9, or catch up on BBC Sounds.
To the weather, most of the UK seeing sunny spells and patchy cloud, a few showers too, most frequent and locally heavy in the north.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb, Michelle Hussein and Caroline Nichols with the news.
Joe Biden has addressed the Democratic Party's National Convention, where Kamala Harris will be formally confirmed as their presidential nominee later this week. The outgoing US president said he would be the Harris campaign's best volunteer. His former senior adviser, Anita Dunn, told this programme he would do everything he could to ensure his vice president defeats Donald Trump. The search for six people missing after a luxury yacht sank off the coast of Sicily has resumed. They include the British technology tycoon Mike Lynch, his 18-year-old daughter Hannah, and Jonathan Bloomer, the chairman of the Morgan Stanley International Bank. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is travelling to Egypt to continue his push for a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza. Mr. Blinken said Israel had accepted what he called a bridging proposal and urged Hamas to do the same. In the past half an hour, the Israeli army says it has retrieved the bodies of six hostages in southern Gaza. The first £1 coins featuring the king will come into circulation this week. Nearly 3 million of the new designs will be distributed via post offices and banks.
Caroline, thank you very much. Let us pick up on that news from the Israeli army that it has retrieved the bodies of six hostages from a southern area of Gaza, Khan Yunis. It was after a joint operation with Israel's internal security agency, Shin Bet. John Donison, our correspondent, joins us from Jerusalem. What do we know of these six people, these six hostages, John?
Well, this news has just come through, or has been confirmed in the last half an hour or so. The IDF said the bodies were discovered in Khan Yunis in the south of the Gaza Strip. They were the bodies of Yagev Buchstab, Alexander Danzig, Avram Munda, Yoram Metzger, Haim Perry and Nadav Popowell, who was a British citizen. All were captured by Hamas from two kibbutzes in the October the 7th cross-border raid last year, and all but 79-year-old Avram Munda were already presumed to be dead.
Do we know how and when they died?
We don't know that. Some of them, it has been suspected that they had been dead for some time, and we don't know where or how their bodies were being held in Gaza. We've had a statement through in the last few minutes from the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who of course has faced a lot of criticism from some hostage families for not doing enough to free those being held. And he said, "Our hearts grieve over the terrible loss. There are around 60 hostages who are still thought to be alive, still being held in Gaza."
I can see that several of them, of the six, were from the same kibbutz near Oz, and that they had, all of them, it seems, had family members or certainly people they knew who were killed on October the 7th, and some who were released, for whom this will be the worst possible news, especially at a time when it seems that we might be close to a deal.
That's right. And it comes as the US Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, travels to Egypt today to continue to apply diplomatic pressure to try to secure a ceasefire and hostage release deal. He was in Israel yesterday, where he said that Benjamin Netanyahu had accepted and supported what he called the bridging proposal to get to that deal. But you're right. I mean, we had more protests last night from hostage families calling for more to be done to try and secure the release of those who are still being held. And as you say, some of those people who we've now learnt have died. They had family members who were killed during that raid on October the 7th, but also some of their family members were taken into Gaza at the same time, and some of those have already been released.
John Donison, thank you.
It is just come up to 20 to 9. It is all quiet here in Chicago. It's just us and the cleaners in the convention centre. It's the middle of the night. The crowds have long left the arena. Joe Biden has also departed the scene with a parting endorsement of Kamala Harris and her vice presidential pick, Tim Walz.
Kamala and Tim understand that this nation must continue to be a place of possibilities, not just for the few of us, but for all of us. But join me in promising your whole heart to this effort and where my heart will be. I promise I'll be the best volunteer Harris and Walz has Cam have ever seen.
Where's this week going to leave the party and the presidential race? I've been talking to Steve Israel, who was for many years a Democratic congressman. He's now a commentator on the party and its affairs. So what needs to happen this week to make it a successful convention?
There are still so many American voters who have not yet been exposed to Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. So this is a way of introducing the top of the ticket to voters who are not particularly engaged yet. The second strategic imperative is to excite the base. And having spent the evening at this convention, I can tell you the base is excited. It took me 2 hours to get into the building. Very long lines with members of Congress and governors and big donors. So you want to make sure that the base is motivated. But the most important strategic imperative is speaking to that small and narrow band of undecided voters in the battleground states, places like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. This is a four-day advertisement for the Democratic presidential ticket to those independent, moderate voters who can just as easily vote for Donald Trump as Kamala Harris.
Is it also aimed, though, at providing for her paths to victory? Paths to victory in the Electoral College that don't necessarily depend on particularly the Rust Belt states, the Michigans and the Pennsylvanias, etc., but actually could open up interesting new pathways for her.
Well, interesting new pathways have indeed opened up since President Biden made the decision to stand down. And Kamala Harris very quickly consolidated. And so the math that would have elected Joe Biden president was really very limited. The path was very narrow. Basically, it was Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And if he had lost any one of those, election over, Donald Trump becomes president. You're exactly right. Kamala Harris's path now has broadened. And so every battleground state, even those outside of the Rust Belt, places like Nevada, places like Arizona, places like North Carolina, are now in play. And so this convention occurs in a completely unpredictable but much more favorable battlefield for the Democrats.
The Biden-Harris presidency, President Biden's presidency with Kamala Harris as vice president, is not popular. That's what all the polls say. How do they deal with that here? How separate has she got to be from him when she leaves this city?
She has got to define herself. She has to tell her own story. It's very difficult to do that when you are the vice president or a vice presidential candidate. But now she does have to have her own identity. And she began doing that just several days ago. Just several days ago before the convention, on the eve of the convention, she gave a speech talking about her economic strategies, platforms, programs, and priorities for the American people. And in sum and substance, it reflected the policies of the Biden administration. But she elevated her own priorities, talking about the need to expand home ownership and to make it more affordable in America, talking about needing to get costs down for the American people. President Biden and the administration certainly supported those priorities, but she has elevated them and made them more a part of her own campaign platform, plank, and her own campaign identity.
Is it fair to say she's an economic populist? I mean, almost in the Trumpian way, because one of the things she's suggesting is price controls, which Donald Trump criticized. But actually, you could sort of see him coming up with that as well. It's an interesting potential path, isn't it?
I'm not sure that she would describe herself as an economic populist, but many of the themes that she has started to elevate and that she will continue to elevate and that we will hear during the course of this convention, I think will be directly aimed at the economic anxieties of the American people. The fact that inflation, although it's going down, it's sticky. People still feel it. And she's going to be talking about the responsibility of, you know, some very greedy people in keeping prices up when they can lower them. Very similar programs.
What does she do about Gaza? Because we've had demonstrations outside the convention center and potentially inside during the course of the week as well. How does she approach that, do you think?
In the way that she has. And so on the fundamentals, she has been very much a part of the administration's strategies with respect to Gaza, sending carrier strike groups to the Mediterranean, bolstering Israel's military presence on the fundamentals. However, she has also reflected a concern for the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. We cannot be blind to that. And I say that as a very strong supporter of Israel. My name is Israel. You can't get better than that. But I also understand that there is a humanitarian crisis and there is a need for a ceasefire and a hostage release. And so I think while she will be aligned with the fundamentals of U.S. geostrategic policy in the Middle East, continue to support the United States' commitment to Israel's responsibility to defend itself, she will also be giving voice to many concerns by the American people about the humanitarian crisis, the need for a ceasefire, and the release of hostages.
Steve Israel, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Many thanks.
It's coming up to 9:15. No one in the UK should be able to buy a vape containing THC or spice. One is the main ingredient in cannabis, the other is a synthetic cannabinoid. And yet, spice has been found in vapes confiscated from schools in England. One 16-year-old who became addicted to smoking spice through his vape has spoken to our reporter Annabelle Rackham alongside his mum.
I'm literally doing it just so I can feel normal, kind of, and regulated. There still wasn't that voice in my head kicking in, like, you shouldn't be doing this. I still, like...
You couldn't stop.
Yeah, I couldn't stop. I found myself doing it literally every second of the day, like, every 3 seconds I had, every 5 minutes. Like, there'd always be that thing in the back of my head that was like, oh, you're not high as you were, like, 10 minutes ago. You may as well have another bit, and then...
Were you doing it in class?
Yeah, I was bringing it to school, like, everywhere. I wouldn't leave anywhere with it. I just...
During lessons?
Yeah. I'd literally put it in my sleeve. I'd, like, do that, and then I'd just use it in class.
Well, some police forces in England and Wales are now using a new test to work out quickly if a vape they confiscate contains THC or spice. DC Nick Burnett is from Devon and Cornwall Police, which is one of the forces involved. Good morning, DC Burnett.
Good morning.
How big is the problem in Devon and Cornwall?
We're just scratching the surface, really. But our kind of figures do mirror what Professor Chris Pudney has kind of found when with his bigger testing figures that he's done. But it is an issue, and it's about highlighting and educating the children about what they're taking. I don't think the message anymore about don't take drugs doesn't work. So we need to try and highlight the dangers and make them more educated and make better informed decisions.
And I guess the point of the new test or device you're using is you'll be able to figure out much more quickly without sending the vapes off what they contain.
Yeah. So the machine that is being devised by Chris and his team at Bath University will indicate whether it contains spice or THC within the matter of minutes. So, yeah, rather than sending them off and waiting months for the results, we can get a really quick quick turnaround of those results.
And does it seem that the way this works is that the vapes are sold illegally as THC vapes, but then they end up can often contain spice?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, the children buy them believing they're THC, and they're buying them because they're cheap. A genuine THC vape that contains 1 gram of THC will set you back about £35, whereas they're getting these for about £10, and they're normally predominantly a clear liquid that they then put into their vape machines, thinking they've got a cheap, good deal, but it's not, and it's making them unwell.
But they're attracted to the THC vapes in the first place.
Absolutely. That is the target market that they're after, and that's what they believe they're buying.
And in most cases, are they buying them online, or are there retailers who are selling these?
It would be social media, dark web, TikTok, kind of all the variety of social media, Telegram and everything else that's out there.
Are you able to tackle that, or is that beyond your forces' capabilities? Is that done on at a different level?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to target it is to actually educate the children, make them aware of what they're potentially going to buy, and therefore make them stop. Target that market is the easiest and the safest target audience to hit. If we can stop them from buying it, then obviously the demand goes down naturally.
DC Nick Burnett from Devon and Cornwall Police, thank you.
It is 12 minutes to nine. The BBC has uncovered testimony from what may be one of the worst mass killings in Myanmar's civil war. Hundreds of civilians from the Rohingya Muslim community bombed apparently on August the 5th as they tried to flee the conflict. In recent months, scores of Rohingyas have been killed and thousands have fled to Bangladesh. But now they say they're being attacked by the other side, by those fighting the military, the rebel group, the Arakan Army. Yogita Limaya reports now from Bangladesh, and I should say her report contains some distressing descriptions.
I'm standing on the Bangladeshi side of the Naaf River. This is the border between Bangladesh and Myanmar in this part of the country. And across on the other side, I can see Myanmar's Rakhine State, specifically the Mongdo town. That's where we know there have been violent attacks against Rohingya Muslims in recent months. Several of them have told us that they're being attacked by the ethnic rebel group, the Arakan Army. But what we're specifically looking into is an incident which took place on the 5th of August, where we're told by many eyewitnesses and survivors that potentially as many as 200 Rohingya Muslims were killed by drone strikes and other bombs. Every day, at least 4 or 5 boatloads of Rohingyas are arriving. They come in the dead of the night so that they're not arrested by Bangladeshi security forces who might send them back. Among them is a man who witnessed what happened on the 5th of August, and he's lost pretty much everyone in his family.
The Arakan Army dropped bombs on us using drones. We heard a loud sound and an explosion. We were thrown on the ground. I, my wife, my mother, my daughter, son and sister were there when the bomb struck. All of them died. I don't know why I survived. My daughter died in my arms.
He He showed us a video he found online of the aftermath of the bombing. In it, you can hear a man crying and saying, all of the people have died. It's distressing to watch, but it's crucial evidence of what appears to be a massacre. The ground is covered with bodies. Many of them are children. The man's wife, who was fatally injured but alive, is visible in the video. So is his sister. He wasn't able to carry them out. They died later. The Rohingyas are among the most persecuted communities in the world. In 2017, thousands were killed in Myanmar and a million fled to Bangladesh. At the time, the violence was carried out by the military. I've come to one of the densely packed, squalid camps they're still living in Bangladesh. Homes are temporary bamboo structures here. I've come to meet one of the survivors of the 5th of August attack who's hiding in a home here. His parents, children and wife were killed.
I have no words to describe how I feel. I miss my family so much. Every time I think about the beautiful life I had, I burst into tears. The drones that hit us were fired by Arkan Army.
In these camps, we've spoken to more than a dozen survivors, all of whom have told us they were deliberately attacked by the Arkan Army. In response to the BBC, the group has said that the attack didn't happen in the area under their control and that they have no connection with it. The Arakan Army has been making rapid advances in the Rakhine state and it's projected itself as a resistance group that's fighting for the people against the military junta. But from what we've heard here now, it faces credible accusations of the mass killing of civilians. And there are calls for it to be investigated for war crimes. I've asked here if we can make a phone call to somebody who's over in Mongdor to get a sense of the situation.
Hello?
Hello? We're not naming the man we called to protect him. He tells me the Arakan army has forcibly taken people out of their homes and are keeping them together in schools, mosques and other shelters. The group has said it's evacuating people to keep them safe from the ongoing civil war. But the man rejects their claim, breaking down as he explains his condition.
I'm 65. Both my mother and I are ill. But we cannot move out of here, because if we do, the Arakan army will shoot us. Please save us if you can.
In Myanmar's Rakhine state, the military junta is losing ground rapidly. They should have given hope to Rohingyas of a possible return to their land. Instead, for the hundreds of thousands still living in Myanmar, once again, it's a precarious moment.
Yogita Limaya reporting, and Yogita's written version of that investigation is on the BBC News website now. It is 5 to 9, and tonight, this phenomenon will leave our shores. So well, this was the summer of Taylor Swift's European tour. Tonight it ends with a final appearance at Wembley. It was the tour that parents and children went to together, groups of friends. Everyone who managed to be there seemed to have a glow about them. And somehow there also seemed to be a spillover, a wider feel-good factor as others heard about it, an antidote perhaps that we needed to the angry scenes of the last couple of weeks. Well, as it comes to an end, we're joined by two people who are both Swifties and who both went along to the gigs this summer. Dr. Iona Murphy is a lecturer in English literature at the University of Huddersfield, an official Taylor Swift advisor to the Victoria and Albert Museum, and Hadley Freeman has written about her love for Taylor Swift in the Sunday Times. Welcome. Morning to you both.
Hi.
Hadley, what was the experience like? Do you think we can say that it really added something to this summer?
Well, it definitely added something to my summer. So I went to see her on the first Saturday at Wembley and then also the last Saturday at Wembley, so 3 days ago. And it was just the most joyful experience. The thing about Taylor Swift is she's one of those rare celebrities who really enjoys connecting with her public, who really enjoys the impact she has on her public. Someone who is that famous tends to retreat from the world, tends to slightly turn away from their fans because it's too overwhelming. And Taylor Swift doesn't do that, even aside from the fact the music is so good and there's something that appeals to everything. She is a rare, joyful celebrity, and that does impact the viewing experience of seeing her and also listening to her. So when I look back on this summer, I will think about Taylor Swift. Yeah. I didn't take any holidays this summer. I spent my holiday money on going to see Taylor.
the joy that Hadley speaks of, Iona, it's so interesting because I think there is a spiller. I didn't go to one of these, but I feel she added something to my summer because I could see the sort of atmosphere that she generated and all the pictures people shared, you know, especially going in these family groups. Groups of different ages.
Yeah, most definitely. I'm the same. My whole summer has been completely dedicated to Taylor Swift. I've been to 3 concerts, and if I'm not at the concerts, I'm watching some live stream just to see what the surprise songs are. So it's such a lovely atmosphere, and seeing everyone so happy and excited about it is just so magical.
What is the Victoria and Albert link? What did you do for them?
So over the summer up until the 8th of September, there's a Taylor Swift trail across the museum. So it was curated by Kate Bay.
Oh, are you still there, Iona? Oh, OK, but maybe we'll come back to Iona in a second there. I mean, that's interesting in itself, Hadley, the idea that a museum like the V&A in London has got a Taylor Swift trail.
Well, I think it's completely right, to be honest. The V&A has done exhibitions that have slightly mystified me in the past, to be entirely honest, of various celebrities. But Taylor Swift is someone who has become a global cultural phenomenon at exactly the time that pop culture has become entirely atomized. I am someone who spends an enormous amount of time looking at the mail online and reading celebrity magazines, and I have no idea really who people like Jenna Ortega are. I can only name like 2 Olivia Rodrigo songs. And yet, I'm 46 years old. I know every single Taylor Swift song. So does my 11-year-old goddaughter. So does my 9-year-old son. She is someone who everybody of every generation loves. And like you said, at Wembley and at all the shows, there are whole families. There are groups of middle-aged women like myself. There are groups of 20-something men, gay men, straight men, whichever, groups of children. And that makes for a really wonderful experience. And I go to a lot of live music shows, and I've never been to one where the atmosphere is so feels like we're all in a club together, and also is so peaceful and happy because the audience there is majority female of all ages. Yeah. That creates a really lovely non-beard up, non-Makizo, non-aggressive atmosphere, and that in itself is very joyful.
And has she also cultivated that particularly through the things that she's made her own and Iona become the culture of this, like the friendship bracelets?
Yeah, absolutely. And also the songs are very female perspective. It's all about her experience of heartbreak and her experience of breaking men's or boys' hearts and her experience of growing up. So it is a very female, culture in a sense. And that also is very lovely.
But Iona, the dads are there. I mean, not only dads, but plenty of men are there too, right?
Yeah, it's really fun seeing like the dads in the sort of Taylor Swift t-shirts or some of my personal favorite outfits, the dads who haven't got any hair and then they put the gems on their heads.